Earth explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. And welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. The solar wind tonight is a medium 419.6 kilometers per second. There are no sunspots to report right now. I know you tune in to X Squared Radio for the latest and most investigative news about the mysteries of the universe and the Earth. Well, things have been escalating at an amazing rate. Almost unannounced, 3 weeks ago, yesterday at 6:01 in the morning, a Delta II rocket launched with the Themis science experiments aboard. This is a series of five small satellites that are being hurried into space to check on some mysterious aspects of the Aurora Borealis. We know them as the Northern Lights in this hemisphere. Themis is a mission to investigate what causes auroras in the Earth's atmosphere to dramatically change from slowly shimmering waves of light to wildly shifting streaks of color. Discovering what causes auroras to change will provide scientists with important details on how the planet's magnetosphere works and the important Sun-Earth connection. It seems strange that as we mount the North Pole Inner Earth expedition to find the source of these atmospheric lights, NASA is multitasking like never before to gain the same knowledge. You can go to nasa.gov/Themis to find out more about this incredible leap in space exploration. Is it the Sun or the Earth that is responsible for these lights? And who will find out first? You have heard us talk here at X Squared Radio about the beginning of the spirit race. Well, there are more details coming soon. Of course, you know, last month we had Ken Payne, and this month, on the 25th, we will unlock the secret for you. You will finally have the tools you need to manifest your dreams into reality. Of course, it means you're going to have to start dreaming good and positive things, and you're going to have to start dreaming big, really big. We'll tell you more about it in upcoming programs. Hey, next week on X Squared Radio, we're going to have David Sereda. He is the author of The Singularity. He'll be on the program talking about that, new energy, and new environmental issues. Trust me, you don't want to miss that program. He's got a lot of good energy. Next week, I already told you that. Hang on just a second here. I'm on the road today, so I'm not as well organized as I normally am. Tonight, our guest almost needs no introduction. He's the author of Guardians of the Holy Grail, The Knights Templar, John the Baptist, and The Water of Life. His resume goes on and on. He's an accomplished author and spiritual teacher, and he presents a history of the Knights Templar and the legendary Holy Grail like none ever before. His website's listed on our website at X Squared Radio, and the book is available, I assume, everywhere. We'll talk to him in just a moment. Anyway, Mark Pinkham, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you, Brooks. It's wonderful to be here, and I'm fabulous because the weather is fabulous outside. We're in sunny Sedona here.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, Sedona. I've heard about that place. A very spiritual mecca, it seems, in this country.
Well, yeah, and, you know, there's some major claims that are made about it, and I would say that the majority of them are true. Okay, that's what I have to say about it, because the energy is very powerful, and in the first couple days you're here, you can expect to keep looking down at your feet to see if they're touching the ground, because it feels like you're walking at least a couple feet off the ground.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've been through your book, Guardians of the Holy Grail, many times. Each time I go through this, I find something else that makes me wonder about the powers that men have had in their hands. It seems that tens of millions of people have been fascinated and even scared by these powers. Recently, we had a movie made of a best-selling book about the Da Vinci Code, and when I was in Roslyn Chapel about a year and a half ago, I saw your book for sale in their little bookstore. That little facility has been visited by millions of people making a pilgrimage to find out about this mystery. And I was going to tell you, in one of these renditions, we were treated to the idea that Mary Magdalene herself was the Grail. Well, let's talk about that. What do you say about that?
Well, Brooks, that whole idea of Mary Magdalene being the Grail started basically with the publication of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is early 1980s. And it was based upon the research that the three authors had done. And they had come across some documents in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris that they believed at the time to be true and authentic. Now they're saying that they feel like they were bogus documents, but at the time, they were convinced they were accurate, and they started talking about, well, an ancient bloodline. And so they investigated these documents, and one thing led to another. I'm pretty sure they decided that Jesus and Mary did marry, and that they had or created a bloodline between them. And one of the main reasons that they came to this conclusion, I think that a lot of it was not very well supported, but one of the main reasons they came to it was because they believe that in the ancient legends of the Holy Grail that were written in 1300s, that the true writing of Holy Grail, which of course we know it is Sang Real, should be Sang Real, which means blood royal, and so they were saying there was some kind of conspiracy, or there was some kind of covert activity going on in order to change that, to make it Sang Real, make it Holy Grail rather than blood royal. So it was. I think that a lot of it was not very well supported, and within the last few years, they've actually come out and said, "Well, you know, we found out that these documents that we found in the Bibliothèque Nationale aren't exactly authentic, and looks like they were planted by a man named Pierre Pelletier, or Plantard, is his name, Pierre Plantard, who at the time called himself the head of the Priory of Sion, and said that the Priory of Sion had been guarding the bloodline of Jesus and Mary for virtually, you know, thousands of years. Well, Pierre Plantard eventually recanted his statements, and then he died right after that.
And, oh my goodness! So he recanted his statements that they were false, and then
he recanted his statement that they were true. That there was a bloodline. That there was the Prior of Sion. Just before he died, he said, "Well, okay, let me revise my statements. Actually, the Prior of Sion has only existed since the 1800s with Bernard Saunier down in Rennes-le-Château. Okay, it existed at that time. It didn't really go all the way back as far as I said it did before, and that's kind of how it was left. That." Somehow or another, it was in existence during the time of Saunier, and then Plantard died, and that was the end of that. Well, anybody who's done any research can see that there was a Prior of Sion in the Holy Land. It appears as though it could have been connected to the same kind of the same people he said it was. But it was a monastery. It was a monastic community. They had only existed until 1188, when the Muslims reclaimed the Holy Land, and then the monks left. And it looks like they went down to Calabria in Italy, and some went to Orléans in France. But that was basically the last you really hear of it. You know,
wow.
And it wasn't really a subversive, covert sort of secret society either. It was just a monastic community. So, there isn't any hardcore evidence to support that idea anymore, which is one reason that we're having a Holy Blood, Holy Grail conference in Glastonbury this summer in July. We're going to bring together a lot of the major speakers on the Holy Grail over the years, Lynn Picknick, Clive Prince, Christopher Knight, Andrew Sinclair, myself, and we're going to really try to present truly what is the Holy Grail and the aftermath of all this stuff, all this what we consider to be this misinformation, saying that the Holy Grail was simply the body of Mary Magdalene, trying to get people back on track and trying to really clarify what truly is the Holy Grail, because all you have to do is go back and start reading some of the texts that came out during the 1300s, like Per Lesvos. That was a rendition of the Holy Grail that said that there was actually five forms of the Holy Grail.
Yeah, how many different kinds of grails are there?
Right, there's all kinds of grails. Well, after a number of texts came out saying there's many, many forms, they decided, well, there's four main forms. And then you've got the chalice, you've got the spear, you've got the rock, and you've got the sword. Those are the four main forms of the Holy Grail. And from that point on, it was just assumed that, yes, there's at least four forms and probably a lot more, you know. And this carried right down to the present time almost until these people come along and say, no, that's all wrong. There's only one Holy Grail, and that's the body of Mary Magdalene.
Well, yeah, but I often look at who's got the most to gain by that decision coming out. You know, in statistics, sometimes when you say, you know, 4 out of 5 dentists say this, and then you see that, you know, they're recommending a toothpaste for which 4 out of 5 of them held stock in the company, it kind of throws the statistics off. So I kind of follow the money when it comes to stuff like this. Who is it? Is it the church? Is it the government? Is it royalty that's saying this or that or the other thing is the grail, and does it give them any specific power over the people or some special notoriety?
Well, it gave power to Pierre Plantard is what it did. He claimed that he was in that lineage, that royal lineage that goes all the way to Jesus and Mary, so he had claims to the throne of France. That's who was benefiting by it.
Well, I mean, when I grew up Catholic, and I'm not Catholic now, but I grew up Catholic, and I was taught by my teachers that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute who Jesus took mercy on, and she was even found, she was featured in the rock opera about Jesus. I think it was Jesus Christ Superstar. So who was Mary, really? I mean, what was the thing that made Mary Magdalene so powerful and so frightening to the church?
Well, I think that the Gnostic texts that have come out in the last 50 years kind of say it all. The Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, they all point to Mary having been one of the closest, if not the closest, disciple to Jesus, and also that, you know, it's said that he loved her more than all the other disciples. He would kiss her directly on the lips, and that he actually told her some secrets that they didn't, that he didn't tell any of his other disciples. It's right in the Gnostic Gospels. Of course, you know that during all these different councils of Nicaea, all these different texts were thrown out, all the Gospels were thrown out, because it was saying things like that. It was saying how powerful Mary was. Well, in our tradition, you see, ours is a tradition that actually comes through Mary Magdalene and John the Apostle. And so she is, we consider her to be extremely powerful, extremely great. We believe that the true spiritual power, Jesus' spiritual power and wisdom, really passed to those two rather than St. Peter and the church, okay? And there's actually documented evidence that this is true, especially if you study the Apostolic Johannic Church today. They have the documents of how the lineage was passed, you know, from Jesus to John the Apostle to Mary, down this line of Johns. That was kind of their regal title, you know. And then that continued until the 12th century when it was passed to the Templars. And Hugh de Payens became John number 68 at that point. And from that point on, that lineage was completely interconnected with the Templars, and they took it into Europe, and they perpetuated this very esoteric, powerful lineage. And one thing we found is that lineage went way beyond Jesus. So it was around way before Jesus. It went through John the Baptist, and before him it was with the Mandaeans who came from the east, and they started in Sri Lanka. So that takes it back many, many thousands of years ago.
I was just going to ask a question. When I went over to the UK, I drove up into Scotland, and what I was trying to do was get to my family's location, which was a little town called Stranraer on the western coast of Scotland. They were the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway, and I just kind of wanted to get back to my roots. Well, we went to Roslyn Chapel first. I spent about 5.5 hours there outside of Edinburgh, and then we drove to Stranraer. Well, when I finally found the castle, I noticed that on the castle outside were the same coat of arms and things that I found at Roslyn Chapel. And then I did some digging, and I found out they were the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway, that they were the magistrates over most land transfers in the 13th and 14th centuries. And I did some more digging and found out that, it was Edward the Bruce and Sir Andrew Agnew were very close and worked with those that built Roslyn Chapel as protectors, as knights, and that they were Templars. So I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I'm more tied into this than I ever thought. And, you know, we looked at documents, we looked at things that were in the museum there in Stranraer, and there in what we would call a town square in the United States is a little castle called John's Castle. And it sits over the town spring, which I guess was the source of fresh water for the townspeople. So here is all this synchronicity with everything that's going on in the Da Vinci world in a town 70 miles to the west of Roslyn. So I've been trying to do some research. It's one of my fascinations about having you on the program, because you're the renowned expert. You're the one that knows, what the Templars were doing and why they were so, had the appearance of being so powerful.
Well, it sounds like you're one of us, Brooks. It's get ready for lots of censure.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Well, I don't know. I'm just a silly talk radio host, a physicist with delusions of grandeur, I should say. I took a class recently, and somebody in the class said something about Mary being part of the Church of Seven Demons. There's a Church of Seven Demons in France. And I think it's called the Church of Mary, or Mary's Church, or Mary's School. I can't remember what it was called in French, but it's common knowledge that Mary Magdalene was actually married to Jesus.
Well, and yeah. It's becoming common knowledge that she was referred to as his companion in the Gnostic texts, and companion meant the same as wife in the time that the Gospels were written. It's becoming common knowledge that she was a very wealthy person, came from a very wealthy family, and that the Magdalene was actually a title. It was a kind of a regal title and a title of her spiritual advancement. Right after the supposed ascension of Jesus, John the Apostle and Mary Magdalene, they were kind of inseparable for a long time because they were the two heads of the lineage at that point. And they went up to Ephesus and hung out there. And later on, they became the kind of the patron and patroness of all the Gnostic sects, right? And Mary became associated with Sophia. She was recognized as an incarnation of the goddess Sophia, the Gnostic goddess Sophia. And she was also recognized as an incarnation of Venus. I mean, she had all these kind of titles that were attributed to her by the Gnostics eventually. So she was considered to be just one of the most incredible incarnations of the goddess of all time. And she was recognized as incarnation of Venus for two reasons, one of which is because Venus is the planet of passion and love. And, of course, that's what Mary was associated with, whether you consider her to be the wife of Jesus or a prostitute. She definitely was associated with that kind of energy. But it was more than that. The Gnostics and the alchemists considered Venus to be the star of alchemy, they called it. And just by its cycles and its movements in the heavens, it gives a lot of alchemical information. The energy of Venus is to bring things together. It's the power of attraction. Well, that's what alchemy is all about. You try to attract two polar opposite substances together, merge them together into one alchemical stone, a philosopher's stone or elixir. So you call upon that energy of love or that energy of passion. So you call upon, if you're an alchemist, you call upon Mary. You call upon the goddess Mary, St. Mary Magdalene. So she... Go ahead.
I was going to say, a lot of people ask me the question, because because I have a degree in chemistry and physics, they asked me, all right, what is alchemy, really? I mean, are you turning lead into gold? What is the big thing? Why don't you just go dig the gold up? And I said, well, you know, my study is that relative to the Templars and relative to the ancient art of alchemy, it is not just base metals into gold. It's creating value out of nothing. And it seems that the medieval Templars, the 14th and 15th century Templars, did figure out how to do that. And
oh, definitely,
all you have to
yeah.
do is look at the dollar bill and look at all the Freemasonry, the Masonic symbols all over the dollar bill, which is generally just paper. It's not backed really by anything.
Well, we
it's
know
just,
that, yeah.
It's just backed by the talismans that are on the dollar bill.
That's right. No, there's no question, Brooks, that the Templars were experts in alchemy. They studied with many Sufi sects in the Middle East, and at that time the Sufis were the greatest alchemists all over the world. They had gone all over Egypt and India, all over the East, and they had gathered together all the sacred alchemical texts and brought them back to the Middle East and cataloged them, filed them away, and they became the teachers of the Templars. Geber, you know, he was one of the greatest alchemists at that time. There was all kinds of Sufi alchemists running around the Middle East when the Templars were there. And so they got a lot of information that way, but they also received information about alchemy from this lineage, this Gnostic lineage, because Jesus actually practiced a form of yoga, and he was also very adept at alchemy. I mean, Jesus was an Essene. What do you think they were doing down on the Dead Sea? They were actually using that sea salt to create the alchemical elixir. So this information was passed to the Templars, because see, the Templars became what we call Gnostics. They their search was to awaken psychic centers within them that held this wisdom of who and what they are and what the universe was all about. But in order to awaken those centers, you've got to go through the process of alchemy, which is yoga. Yoga is a form of alchemy, which is creating the alchemical pill or the alchemical elixir. I think the Templars were adept in all forms of alchemy. You see, the Gnostic path, the alchemical path, they're two sides of the same coin. You know, you can't get completely established in that wisdom, that Gnostic wisdom of I am God or I am the universe, unless you go through the alchemical transformation to get you to it, you see.
So you're saying that the alchemical process is not just to create wealth, it's to create immortality?
Absolutely. If you go back to the East, the alchemy has existed in the East for thousands of years. They don't care anything about using alchemy to transmute lead into gold. They don't care anything about that. They care about using it to transmute a human into a god being, a divine being. That's what all they care about alchemy for, and it's been existing there for many thousands of years before we had it in the West. You know, it's only when it really got to the West that they really started using it for that. I mean, they used it a little bit in China for that, but it was mostly the Taoist masters and the Taoist philosophers that were using it there. And in India, it was mostly the sages of South India, the Siddhas, practicing the Rashayana path. You know, it was primarily a path to enlightenment is what it was.
Well, there are those that say that young Jesus and possibly his brother left Egypt and went to the East to learn from the time, oh, I guess he was about 14 to the time he was about 28 and a half. Are you saying that maybe he went to the East to learn from these very masters?
Well, you couldn't avoid it. That's what was happening all over India. It was the Buddhists, actually, that started writing these texts called the Tantras. And in the Tantras was all this information about how you could transform yourself into a divine being, how you could essentially evolve yourself. There was alchemy, there was yoga, there was chanting, there was all this stuff. And they started actually putting these texts together, these Tantras, right around the time that Jesus was there. And we know that Jesus, when he was there, he did study with the Buddhists. And those were some of his primary teachers. And besides studying, it looks like from, you know, the Brahmin priests of the Hindu tradition, but definitely with the Buddhists, and they were the ones at that time that had that, you know, alchemical yoga information, and they were these tantric sects all over India. So Jesus couldn't have helped but have been exposed to that when he was over there. There's no question. But we also know that there was a kind of a Jewish yoga that he practiced too, that the Essenes, the Essenes were practicing, because later on, Moses de Leon, it looks like, or some of the other Jews in Spain started repopularizing this ancient form of yoga that had been passed down through their lineage to them, and it appears as though, you know, so many of the Essenes and Jesus and so many of the prophets had been practicing this form of yoga. Where it came from, we don't know for sure. It could have come from Egypt. It could have come from the East. It could have maybe even come from Sumeria. It's hard to say. But there was a huge mixing of information in the Middle East, as you can imagine. It's a crossroads of East and West. And so you get all this Egyptian, Sumerian, Mesopotamian, Persian, Chinese, Hindu information, all of it passed through there, and it was synthesized. It was actually, when the Templars were in the Middle East, it was the Sufis that actually had synthesized all that information. And they'd done an amazing job. They were really the first ones to have accomplished that, you know, and they were the direct teachers of the Templars.
Well, I know we talk about Gnostics, and really that just means, you know, knowers or special knowledge or secret knowledge, but this knowledge may have been known by lots of people. It seems that powerful people since those days have wanted to possess these things. Is there any real power in possession of any of these holy grails today?
Well, there is. I mean, the idea is that what makes something a holy grail is that it has a certain power, it has a certain energy, right? So you want to get a hold of Jesus' cup and drink from it because it's full of spiritual energy, or you want to get hold of some of the relics of the Passion. You want to get a hold of the Crown of Thorns, or the Shroud of Turin, or the Veil of Veronica, or wood of the cross, or nails of the cross. Any of that stuff is believed to be full of that power, that energy. But how it got that power, how did any of these Holy Grail manifestations get that power, is mainly because they were in proximity to Jesus. He either touched them, or his blood and sweat were, you know, filled them up, or something. But just by being on his body or around him, he was able to infuse them with his own spiritual power, and that's what really gives them that energy. That, to my mind, what is the true Holy Grail is that energy itself. It's the power. It's the power of the Holy Spirit. It's in one of the Grail texts, it talks about how the Holy Grail stone is rejuvenated or re-energized every year. It was the Holy Spirit does it, come down and lights on top of it and infuses it with that energy. It's a pure Holy Spirit energy, which in the East they know as Kundalini power. And Kundalini power is the same kind of power that any kind of magician or shaman wants to develop, because once it's developed, then they can manifest things out of thin air if they want. It's like the same kind of power that this being Sai Baba today, he's constantly manifesting ash or gold watches or whatever out of thin air. Masters throughout time have always wanted to get hold of that energy, that power, because you can, you know, create universes with it, basically. And unfortunately, you know, during the time of Atlantis and some of the earlier times, it was used for selfish purposes. And that is one reason that the patriarchal forces at the time decided to downplay that whole goddess tradition and denigrate the goddess, because that was... That whole tradition of working with power comes directly out of the goddess tradition, because it was known that power was her, you see. You know, all the goddess traditions are all about awakening the inner power, using the power for healing, for magic, whatever. You know, even today in Wicca and witchcraft, it's like generating that power so you can use it for manifestation purposes, you know. And this is one reason that the church denigrated the goddess, put her down, because once you get that power awakened within you, it opens you up to your own gnosis, your own understanding. Then they can't control your thinking.
Yeah, then you don't need the church anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I guess I could go a lot of places with this, but one of the things that my listeners want me to ask you is, in your opinion, from your studies and from things that you may know that you didn't put in your book, is there real power in the things, or is it just the love that was around the union of Jesus and his apostles, or Jesus and his mate Mary? Was it the love, or is it the things that he touched that have the power?
No, I think there's no question it was the things that he touched. I mean, the tradition of the Holy Grails have been around for thousands of years. They weren't just in Middle East. In fact, they predated Jesus by thousands of years. I mean, there was a Holy Grail in Persia, and there was a whole knighted order that tried to get a hold of it even before the time of Jesus. There was the cup of Buddha in Mongolia and China that had these divine powers because it had been blessed by Buddha. There was a cup in Samaria that everyone wanted to get a hold of because it had these divine powers. But what gave it these divine powers is some great master just infused his energy into it. And what I believe, see, is that the original Holy Grails were not objects. The original Holy Grails were the masters themselves. They were full of the power. They were chalices themselves, full of this power, which they knew when they called the water of life. They called it the water of life. So they were chalices full of the water of life. You see? And you talk, and if you read between the lines in the Holy Grail text, it says that the true guardian of the Holy Grail is the Fisher King. Right? The Fisher King is the original priest kings. He represents all the original priest kings that used to rule this planet that were full of this power. It was their power that kept their kingdom prosperous and alive. You know, you study all the ancient cultures. It was the kings. It was their power that made their country flourish. And when they turned from the will of God, they became self-serving and they lost their power. And that's what happened to the Fisher King in the Grail text. He became the crippled Fisher King because he was using the power for his own means.
Well, it seems, as I study history in high school and college and books that I've read after that as somewhat of an aficionado, that all kinds of military ventures from the Crusades on up to World War II, the tyrants or those with whom the world was at war were actively seeking these talismans to give them special power in ruling the world, but not for the benefit and charity of mankind, for their own enrichment. It just seems like a lot of that has gone on.
Oh, there's no question about it. And they knew that if they got a hold of these talismans, it was all over. You know, Hitler hung around the Spear of Destiny. We know all about that. You know, they've been passed down among the Holy Roman Empires and went down to King Constantine. He knew that once he had possession of that, he would rule the world. Well, there was also there was called the Chintamani Stone in the East, and legend was that was in this mythical place called Shambhala, and it had mystical powers. This stone, and it actually come from another world. It come from Star of Sirius, and actually pieces of that stone were sent to Solomon and Genghis Khan and some of these other famous rulers. And it was because of the power of that stone that they were able to rule the great kingdoms and defeat their enemies the way they were. You know, I mean,
no,
you find this continually all over the world. Yeah.
Oh yeah, another famous stone. It was just recently, relatively speaking, returned to Scotland, and that's the Stone of Destiny, the Stone of Scone.
Well, that's right. Yeah, but anybody, any research up there will tell you that's not the real one.
It probably isn't, but I did go through the castle at Edinburgh, and it does look authentic, and I got a little replica of it on my bookshelf. But the story,
yeah, but most people tell you it's a fake. Actually, Niven Sinclair has been researching that for quite a while, and what his research has shown is that the original stone of Scone was actually divided up into seven pieces, right, and given to the seven major clans in Scotland, and whenever they came together to make the laws and the rules of Scotland, they would bring their piece of the stone, and they would join it together. And and so he was saying, well, the Sinclairs still have their piece of the stone. Of course, he's not telling me where it is, but you know, that's what he found out when he researched that.
Well, I understand that all the kings of England have been crowned sitting or standing or with that stone underneath their throne.
Right. Well, that's what they've got is sandstone right now. I mean, I've been around that stone a few times, and, granted, sandstone can accumulate some energy, some power, but it doesn't hold a candle to a meteorite, as an example.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or a stone that has a lot more metal associated to it. I think it was originally actually a meteorite, because if you go back to Middle East, at the time when the Stone of Destiny supposedly was taken out of the Holy Land during the time of the prophet Jeremiah and Princess Tamra, all the famous stones of power, they were meteorites. Right? They were all meteorites.
Wow.
And they were they would fall on the ground, and they would be associated with Venus, the star of alchemy. And then they would oftentimes either they would be put into a temple, or they'd be used for initiation in mystery schools, like the thunders of nocturnal Zeus in Crete. All around the Mediterranean, people would flock there to get initiation, because the dactyloi who was doing the initiation, they would take out this gigantic meteorite, place it on your back, and it was so powerful, had such a concentration of nickel and iron that immediately it would interact with your electromagnetic field and get everything pulsing. And when you move energy in that level of your being, it starts moving it in the higher level, more etheric level, and that's the level that Kundalini exists within. So you start moving and awakening the Kundalini as well, and that's what happened to most everybody. So these were a very, very important sacred stones. Even in the Samothracian mysteries, those were the ones that came directly from Atlantis, and these were all about Kundalini awakening. They used meteorites, and they would have meteorite stones that the initiates would wear with them. They could continually contact the Samothrace twins whenever they were in trouble or needed help or needed more spiritual power. But you'll find it was primarily the meteorites that were the really powerful sacred stones at that time.
So they would see them flame down through the atmosphere and mount a caravan to go see if they could find that meteor or meteorite.
Well, that's it. You know, based on the old legend of, Cronus cutting off his dad's genitals, right? And then they come flaming down and land in the Mediterranean, and out comes Venus. That's how she was born, right?
Do you think
since there weren't a lot of flaming genitals coming down through the heavens, they decide, well, it must be the meteorites.
Do you think the star that led the wise men to Bethlehem was a meteorite or a UFO? It couldn't have been a star, because the wise men didn't show up until Jesus was about 2 years old. So it took them a long time. I just doubt that a star would have led wise men from that far away, and they had to have some kind of record that told them what the star was going to mean, and Herod's priests had the same records, so, of course, we don't have those records.
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly what it is. If you subscribe to the idea that the wise men came right after Jesus' birth, then it was probably a conjunction between Saturn and Jupiter. This is known in the East in Vedic astrology as the herald of some great teacher, great master that's going to be born here on this planet. It happens very, very rarely. Otherwise, if it was later on, there's a good chance that it could have been the planet Venus, or it could have very well have been a UFO. I think that there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that they were led there by extraterrestrial craft too.
Yeah, well, we can go into that in depth, but as we finish off this hour, let's jump a little bit ahead. Let's talk about the Cathars. Who are they, and how did they gain their knowledge?
Well, the Cathars, the Cathars, basically, they referred to them as Manichaeans, Manichaeism. Manny was he was born out of into a Gnostic family. He was his father was a Mandean, and his mother was of Persian royalty, and he became a Gnostic and an alchemist, and he actually created the biggest until that time the biggest religion throughout the world. It extended all the way from Spain to China. I mean, just gigantic, but it was very much of a Gnostic religion. Well, so there were Manichaean worshippers in Europe, and apparently they slowly but surely they evolved into the Cathars, and the Cathars were primarily in the Languedoc, southern France, and they were great goddess worshippers, and I think part of that is because there had been a goddess tradition there. It existed for thousands of years as well. I mean, they have done some landscape surveying there, and they've discovered this huge kind of landscape five-point star, symbol of the goddess, within which they had been apparently doing goddess rituals there for, I mean, thousands of years. So they were goddess lovers. Apparently they knew a lot of the secrets of Jesus and Mary Magdalene because those secrets had come up through France, you know. They knew that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were, in truth, had been married. But the main thing is that they were Gnostics, and they didn't feel like they needed any kind of ritual. Their church was the world. Their church was the most beautiful place they could find out in nature. You know, that was their church.
Wow.
And
now, did they come from Jerusalem?
Well, no. They were French people, but the Manichaean religion came from the Middle East. It came from what's now Iraq, and went west.
They find out who Mary really was and what she had with her.
Well, because it appears as though I believe there was like documents and about who Mary was. I mean, this whole area of Languedoc, it was called Septimania, that was actually believed to have been ruled over by a Jewish king at that time. This is a time of about the time of Charlemagne, you see. And so it looks like there was a lot of documents, hidden Jewish documents that existed in that area before the Cathars arrived there. And so I believe that they were actually able to get a hold of a lot of those documents.
Do you think...
But anyway, two things. They were destroyed by the church for, one, because, well, they didn't want to follow any kind of ritual or doctrine or anything. They didn't want to be controlled by the church. And also... because they were dualists, they could see a distinct line between spirit and matter, and they believed that they were from the true spirit world, and they wanted to go back there, just like all Gnostics do. But this world was ruled by a very evil dictator, which they associated with being the Christian Jehovah or Yodivode or Yahweh. You know.
Wow!
And so. To them, he was the true devil.
Yeah. Now, do you think they had possession of Mary's jar?
Oh, yeah, I think that there's a very strong possibility of that, because just Montsegur, the night before they were their mass arrest or their mass burning, I guess, and there was four of them that snuck down off of that precipice with all kinds of sacred items and texts and so forth. And one of the things that they believe they left with was, you know, the cup or the jar of Mary, you know. And so it is believed that it could be in that area. I mean, today we think that the Templars, of course, had many treasures that they had accumulated over time. And the two places that we are looking at is where those treasures are today. Is one is Roslyn Chapel, and the other is in the Languedoc region. The Templars knew about that five-pointed star, apparently, because they actually built their commandery in Béziers, which is right on one of the five points. That big star.
Oh, my goodness.
They knew all about it, apparently.
So they knew right where to build.
Right. See, the goddess, the Gnostic alchemical tradition comes out of the goddess tradition. They're all interconnected. So if you get involved with one, you get involved with the others. I mean, the Templar's eight-pointed star is the ancient symbol of the goddess. It's also an alchemical symbol as well. You know, it shows the affiliation of the goddess, the alchemy, to Gnosis, to all of them.
So now, did the Pope's army ever get their hands on the relics, or did they get snuck away?
Oh, this is 1307, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think the main thing they were looking for is the Baphomet. And the Baphomet is apparently the head of John the Baptist that the Templars were able to find during the Fourth Crusade in Constantinople. They found it in a palace there, and they took it back into Europe, and they placed it on their highest altars. And it was like second-in-command, Hugh Perrod, I guess his name was. He carried it around all the different preceptories when they had special initiations. And apparently that head was still emanating the same kind of power was when it was on the body of John the Baptist. And John was considered to be a master of this Holy Grail lineage, that he had incredible power, Kundalini power, Holy Spirit power at one point. And so in a lot of the Templar initiations, they had that head in proximity to them, and then they would absorb its power, its energy, and awaken their own inner Holy Grail power, their own inner Kundalini power, their own inner Holy Spirit power. But the thing of it is, one of the reasons the Church wanted to get hold of it is because it's a symbol of that Johannite heresy. I believe that the Church knew that there were two lines founded by Jesus. There was the St. Peter line, of course, but there was also the St. John, Mary Magdalene. That was the Gnostic line. That was the line that really received Jesus' spiritual power. You see. And they've always tried to wipe out that line. They've always known about it. All of secret societies, they were all alchemists and Gnostics. They all called themselves Templars. And they, in one way or another, they actually represented that alternative line. And you'll find throughout history that the Church has always tried to destroy all these secret societies. They've always said, because they knew that they were always affiliated to that Gnostic, Johannite line. And if it came to light about the truth about it, then it would come to light that was the true lineage. It was the true lineage and passed through St. Peter, passed through John and Mary Magdalene.
All right, what about the Marian chalice? What's that?
Marian chalice was, I believe that was the one that the Empress Helena found when she went down to the Holy Land from Constantinople, and she had some workers with her, and they were digging around where they believed that Jesus' tomb was, I believe. And then they found pieces of the cross, and they found nails of the cross, and all kinds of things. This is it was because of that later on King Constantine was able to create this this sword or the spear of destiny out of those nails. But anyway, one of the things she found articles of the Passion, and she found this sort of Marian chalice thing, which some say was the true Holy Grail. That was at the Last Supper. That caught the blood and sweat of Jesus. That was the true one, you know.
Now, what was it made out of?
Well, that's the big question, you know. You got people saying that it ended up in England. It's made out of onyx. It's like a one that's either black or white onyx, I guess. And they're saying, well, that's the Marian chalice. And they say, no, it's made out of wood and it's really the Nantios chalice, that was embedded in one of the walls of Glastonbury Abbey for many years, and now it's in Wales. And so nobody really knows for sure, but they do think that one way or another it found its way up to England, I guess.
Wow. Well, I mean, the Nantios cup, let's see. Oh, gosh, was that made out of olive wood?
That's right, yeah.
And, I don't know. I'm trying to think. Was that King Henry VIII?
That's right. He went around destroying all the monasteries, and
wow.
So before he was able to, destroy Glastonbury Abbey, the monks took it out of its hiding place in one of the walls and left with it, and it ended up ended up with a family in Wales, I guess, and that's where it is today.
Well, we're speaking about Jesus relics, and you mentioned the tomb of Jesus, and recently I saw I forget on which cable channel it was, but there was a special on a man who claims to have found the coffin and the bones of Jesus.
Right.
Have you got any thoughts about that? That's kind of current events.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you my thought on that one. In the East, rather than cremating a great teacher, a great master when he dies, right, you entomb him. Why? Because their body continues to emanate out the spiritual energy that that master accumulated while he was alive. And it'll continue to emanate that power for literally hundreds, thousands of years. Just like the head of John the Baptist supposedly emanated his power out of it thousands, a thousand years after John was gone. Right?
Right.
So my belief is that that's the same with any master. Any master is going to, their relics are going to be full of that power. You had the cult of the relics all over Europe, where every cathedral wanted to get a hold of some bone or some tooth or of some prophet or some saint because it had power. It could heal you, you know. And don't you think that if they had found the bones of Jesus, that there would be a heck of a lot of power coming out of those bones?
Well, I would think so. I would think, the cameras would have glitched or there would have been some light coming out of the stone box or something. If there really is this kundalini power, I couldn't think
right,
of
exactly.
anything.
If anybody that was at all sensitive would have been able to sense it entering that tomb or feeling those bones. And, I think that they would probably be so full of energy that you wouldn't be able to keep your feet if you were in the presence of them. You know, that's what I believe, because I've been around so many tombs of deceased masters, and I felt the energy, and that energy just continues, you know, long after they are gone.
Oh, now that's exciting. I definitely want to get into that. All right. Well, listen, now we're going to take about a 7-minute break. Your phone will be live during the break, so if you yell at the dog, it's going to come out on the air. So hang in there. We'll be back in about 6 minutes. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio and my guest, Mark Pinkham. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today.
Thank you.
Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods, supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew, your host. Mark Pinkham is my excellent guest. His book is Guardians of the Holy Grail. And what's your website, Mark?
It's www.gnostictemplars.org. And if you don't know how to spell Gnostic, it's G-N-O-S-T-I-C. So you run it together, gnostictemplars.org. And give you all information about our organization, the International Order of Gnostic Templars, and talk about our tours and our conferences. And one of the things we're trying to do as Templars is to unite East and West spiritual traditions together. We feel like that's what the original Templars were all about, and we are here to complete their mission. So we're having conferences in order to do that. We have one in Glastonbury coming up this summer, and we've got one in Sri Lanka coming up in February 2008. You can come with us to these conferences. Just go to our website and give you all the information.
Yeah, that sounds great. That one in Sri Lanka, that sounds like it'd be great.
A little bit about that, Brooks, is that part of the work that we do in our organization is try to trace back the lineage of the Templars as far back as we can. And what we found is it certainly goes back to John the Apostle, Mary Magdalene, Jesus, John the Baptist. But then we find out that John the Baptist was part of a very ancient lineage or ancient sect called the Mandaeans. And the Mandaeans today still exist. They're in southern Iraq. But they're the only surviving Gnostic sect from ancient times. And they say that John was, a great prophet, a great master of their tradition. But anyway, if you study the histories of the Mandaeans themselves, they say they go back to Sri Lanka, you see. And so they're the lineage, if you will, that John and Jesus and John the Apostle were initiated into goes all the way back to Sri Lanka. And so I've gone there. I've gone there a couple times to investigate this. And what I found is that there's an ancient master. There's a temple city that's dedicated to this ancient master in Sri Lanka. And in the East, he's known as the founder of all the different alchemical and yoga traditions all over the world. And you've got Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists all worshiping the same master. Right? So it appears as though that tradition, the Holy Grail tradition, actually started with him and then went west. He's known as actually the first Kundalini master that ever taught the Kundalini path. And he's known as actually the first Fisher King, the first priest king of the world. All those things that associated with the true guardian, the Holy Grail, he's that, you know. And so we believe that it really started with him. He's also known as the Yon Pandita, the original teacher of Gnosis. So he's both the first Kundalini teacher, master. He's also the first Yon teacher. And as I said, they're Gnostic teacher. So he demonstrates that, Gnosis and alchemy and yoga, they're two sides of the same coin. And he is the original master of both of those. And so we're going back to there. So what I found since also Brooks is that he actually manifests in traditions all over the world, this one same master. He's kind of the link that links them all together. He's also Enki in the Mesopotamian tradition.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. He's Al-Qadir in the initiator of the Muslim tradition. He's Dionysus, he's Osiris, he's Quetzalcoatl. He's actually the Masao, the ruler of the fourth world in the Hopi tradition. He is in traditions all over the world, and so he is the link that links them all together. So what we're going to do is bring representatives from all these traditions to Sri Lanka so they can compare and say, yeah, that's our link. Yeah, that's what unites us together. And hopefully by doing that, it's going to bring more peace and harmony to all the religions around the planet. And it's going to be one of the first steps in actually bringing them back together again, because I think that they all originated with this great being, this great master, and then they went to different parts of the world. Because you know something else is the Muslims say that Sri Lanka is the original Garden of Eden. It all started there. So they worship that as the original Garden of Eden.
What we're talking about here on X Squared Radio, I don't know if it's a world exclusive or not, but you're talking about really affecting the universe. You're talking about reuniting sects of religions that have fought each other for thousands of years, showing them a common root, and maybe precipitating from another way, not weaponry, but another way, world peace.
Absolutely. No question about it. That's exactly what we're trying to do through our Holy Grail Conference. The Holy Grail Conference is, I mean, this was obviously preceding that, but that was meant to be kind of the send-off of this information that this great master on Sri Lanka was and is the link of all these different traditions. He's the original Holy Grail himself. He's the original Fisher King. He's the original founder of all these different traditions. And when I speak at the Holy Grail Conference in Glastonbury, that's going to be his official coming out party, if you will, in the West. And then that's going to be followed up by the conference in Sri Lanka in 2008, where there's going to be a specific focus just on him and how he manifests in all these different traditions, you see. And so it is it is kind of an exclusive at this time. And what we believe, see, that that true religion, or the original religion, it wasn't religion, it was spirituality. It's true gnosis, right? It became clouded over with dogma. That's all that constitutes any kind of religion is its own dogma. That's what priests, that's what ministers are for, is to perpetuate the dogma of that particular tradition. If you cut away, you shear away all the dogma, you've got pure spirituality. That's what you end up with. And we want to shear away all that stuff and take it back to pure spirituality. We believe that that's what was existed in the Garden of Eden before Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden. Pure spirituality, pure connection to a higher self, pure connection to God, direct link to that guidance all the time. And that's what we want to get back to.
Yeah, I think that's a tremendous thing. Now, who's invited to this conference?
Everybody.
Really?
Everybody's invited. Everybody that feels drawn to coming is invited. You're invited. Anybody, everybody and everybody is invited because we're all about uniting everybody together. We're all about uniting all the spiritual traditions together. We're not about excluding anybody. And so everybody who feels drawn to coming is definitely invited to come. And we hope that we do get a lot of people to come and support this.
Well, I feel drawn. So I'm going to try to make arrangements to be there, if maybe in Glastonbury in the summer, and in Sri Lanka in 2008.
Excellent, excellent. Well, let me tell you, you won't be disappointed. It's going to be a very, very powerful time. I want to say one more thing about Sri Lanka, Brooks. Is that confirmation of Sri Lanka being the Garden of Eden, the second highest peak in Sri Lanka is called Adam's Peak.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, and you climb up this Adam's Peak. It's hell of a climb. I've done it. I probably will never do it again. But it's like something like 10,000 stairs, and some of them are nearly straight up. So you need to be in good shape for this thing. But anyway,
camping spots along the way, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. It's great. There's obviously temples all along the way you can stop for worship.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, but I, you know, since I'm not a Buddhist, and they're mostly Buddhist temples, I just kept going. And but it's actually, I would highly recommend if you did stop as much as you can. But actually what I found out is that the Sri Lankan people consider Annas Peak to be such a holy mountain that a lot of them don't take the trek up the mountain until they think they're about to die. Because they want to die on the mountain, and they believe that that's going to actually give them an automatic ticket to heaven or automatic enlightenment or something along those lines. And actually, I saw a woman that looked like she was definitely on her last leg. It looked like she was in her late 80s, and she was being helped up the mountain when I came back down. So.
Well,
but anyway,
hopefully we get young people to go and become enlightened and advanced and gain this testimony so they can come down the mountain and then run for office and try to change things.
Well, we can always hope, can't we? But let me tell you what's up at the top.
Yeah, okay.
There's a huge rock, and indented into that rock is this gigantic footprint. It's about 4 or 5 feet long. And so everybody, you know, is around this footprint. There's a big temple built over it. And they're saying, well, this is the footprint of Adam. This is where God set Adam in the Garden of Eden. Because this is the true Eden. See, the Muslims believe that the true Garden of Eden isn't even of this world. God set Adam and Eve in Sri Lanka because it was the closest thing to the real Eden, which isn't even of this world. It's of another dimension. It's of another world.
Yeah.
But according to the tradition is that when Adam and Eve first arrived here, Adam was placed in Sri Lanka, and Eve, I think, was placed in Mesopotamia someplace. And then Adam did some penance. He actually stood on one foot for something like 100 years, which is why there's only one footprint. And then after that, he went and collected Eve, brought her back to Sri Lanka, and started it all off, started off the whole cycle of creation. But the whole scenario, you know, scenario of the Bible, it appears to be in Sri Lanka, which is interesting because if you study more of that tradition, after Adam was placed on that hill, that mountain, Adam's Peak, he climbed down the mountain and he wandered around the island a little bit trying to find the right place to settle down. And eventually it said that he settled down in the place called Katagama. Katagama is the place where this great master is worshipped today, where Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims all worship this great master. And they call him the original teacher, the Jan Pandita, the founder of the Gnostic tradition. But you know something else, they also worship him. See, the Gnostics worship him as the original instructor of humanity, the original Kundalini power. You know, and so he is that kind of that serpentine power. To them, the whole image of the serpent on the cross, of the serpent on the tree in the Garden of Eden, same with the yogis in India, it's a total metaphor. It represents the spine, the human spine, and the Kundalini serpent on the spine. And this is what the Gnostics knew. They knew that he was the original instructor of Adam and Eve. He instructed them essentially by awakening their own inner kundalini evolutionary force. And it was that force that opened them up to gnosis, the understanding of the world, of the universe and themselves. And they were then they were able to pass on that knowledge to their descendants. Adam is considered to be the first of the Gnostic teachers. So there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, and I have read a lot about that multidimensional aspect or even off-planet aspect of the Garden of Eden. I co-author books myself.
Right. Well, I think that for one thing, Brooks, it's definitely on another. It could be another realm, but I think it's also another dimension here, right here on Earth.
Yeah, I think so too. And in fact, I don't know if you know a little bit about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. There's a fair faction as leader of this expedition. I'm trying to unite the clans, and some of them are quite religious in nature. And they actually believe that the Garden of Eden might be multidimensional and in the inner Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually done a lot of studying on the inner Earth recently because I'm writing a book on giants, because that's what's supposed to be one of the main places the giants live today. That during the time of early cataclysms, a lot of the Lemurian Atlantean giants actually entered in the inner Earth, and supposedly they still exist there. Yeah, absolutely. You know,
I might have to make a spot for you on this boat when we go.
Okay, I'd appreciate that.
It's a once in a, well, maybe twice in a lifetime. We don't know how popular it's going to be, but definitely at least once in a lifetime chance to go to a place that's never been visited by a civilian ship before. And
you're going out to what? Up to the Arctic Circle or what?
Yeah, we're going up to the Arctic Circle. We're going up to about the 80th parallel. I don't want to give the exact location because,
it's just a
set up opposition.
Right.
And try to go up with the most open mind that we can. It's certainly a scientific expedition, and it's also for entertainment, but because we're going to be shooting a lot of film, and hopefully we'll get a great documentary out of it. But we're also going to try to raise the consciousness of the boat to a very high level, like you might find in a typical workshop, only it's 13 days long, and it's 800 miles away from the nearest piece of land. So it's going to be quite unique, and we might be in the right place at the right time for something to happen.
And when are you going to embark on this?
Well, I can't give you the exact day, but it is going to be in the fall. And I'll say it's in the month of August. And if you want, I'll keep you posted as to exactly.
Oh, yeah, it sounds very interesting. Definitely, yeah. And, I'm totally sold that the original Sons of God, the original patriarchs, the original occupants of this planet, where they were giants. You know, there's no question. I mean, that's why Adam's footprint is 5 feet long. I mean, he was apparently like 30 feet tall, you know. The original occupants, they were all giants, there's no question. You know, it's even in the Bible. It talks about how, you know, we were much bigger before, how we lived much longer. It's in the Yugas of India and the different Satya Treta, Dwapar Yuga. We were much taller. We lived much, much longer. And even recently, I don't know if you know that, but there's because of the tsunami on the west coast, the east coast of India, apparently it uncovered some bones, and they're looking at these bones very carefully right now because it looks like they could be the bones of a man that's like 30 feet tall. You know?
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I definitely, we're living in the right time, you and I.
A lot of the mysteries are going to be, come to light at this time, definitely.
Well, that's what this program's all about, the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Let's get back to alchemy just a little bit. Alchemy, it appears, is greatly concerned with numbers. And, what are some of the important numbers in alchemy, and what do you think their origin might be?
Well, certainly, the 5, the 13, kind of similar to the Fibonacci sequence, actually. 5, 8, and 13. 8 is definitely an important number. 13. 9 is actually number 2. You know, they're... recently, we went on a pilgrimage up to the different chakras of Europe that are now have cathedrals placed over them, and all of them have a lot of alchemical symbology. And one of them has Notre Dame in Paris, and it has the goddess in front, and she's actually sitting next to a ladder that has nine levels, nine steps to it. and she's holding the Book of Alchemy in her hands. So apparently there was 9 stages, you know, in creating the alchemical elixir. But there was also, of course, the 13, which is Hermes' tablet, you know, the Emerald Tablet, 13. Which of course, is why in throughout history, 13 has always been the number, supposedly the unlucky number of death. But that's, you know, if you're not looking at it from the spiritual standpoint, it's a death leading to a new life, a spiritual rebirth. But of course, the number 5 is definitely there. They're actually numbers of Venus, you know, all these different numbers. I don't know if you knew that or not, but.
No, I didn't. I recently went through a book by David Horowitz called the Real Da Vinci Code, and he really goes into the numerology of words and names, and it appears that great names like Mary Magdalene and other names have divine power or completeness to them. I recently understood that the name Mary Magdalene is more of a mantle than it is her lineage, and it totals to the number 153 is supposedly a very powerful number as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely. But you know, going back to Venus, it's in a cycle with the Earth. It takes 8 years, right?
Right.
I mean, they're conjunct, and then they separate and they come back together in 8 years. But during that 8 years, the Venus conjuncts the Sun at different points and creates this perfect 5-point star in the heavens, you know, symbol of the goddess. But during that time that Venus is creating this 5-point star, it's going around the Earth 13 times. You know, so you got 5, you got 8, you got 13. You know, they were all numbers of alchemy. One of the most important numbers for the Templars was 8. A lot of their information started by studying the Dome of the Rock, which is on the Temple Mount, because they were given the Alaska Mosque to live in by King Baldwin II, which is right next to the Alaska Mosque, and so they hung out there quite a bit. And you see, the Dome of the Rock is built around the what they call the Rock of Foundation. In those days, it was considered to be the rock in the center of the Earth. It was the rock that united heaven and earth together. It was the rock that Muhammad ascended into heaven, right? And so it held holy grail properties or alchemical properties, because that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to unite heaven and earth together, right? The polarity. And so it had these holy grail properties. So some believe actually today even that that's the original holy grail, because it was also known as the Great Stone in one of the texts. But anyway, in order to enhance the energy of that stone, an octagon was placed around it, this dome of the rock, 8-sided structure. It enhances that energy.
For geometry, right?
Exactly. It's got the 4 and the 4. Look at the Arabic 8. It's got 2 circles representing the top circle is heaven, the lower circle is earth. It's also 8 is 4 and 4. 4 is a square representing an earth in some symbology. So you have two earths, or you have two worlds together, 4 and 4. So it was the 8, you see, that was one of the primary numbers of alchemy, and this is why the Templars actually built so many of their preceptories as octagons, you know, and they were actually the ones behind the Holy Sepulchre church, because it was really in ruins when they showed up during the First Crusade, and they rebuilt it in the form of an octagon, you know, through having studied with the Sufis. Especially there was a sect called the Albana, which was kind of the Sufi Freemasons, if you will, and they taught them a lot about sacred geometry.
And where do you think that stone came from that's in the Dome of the Rock?
Well, it's a gigantic stone. I mean, it's not like the stone in Mecca, which was a meteorite, which was placed into the Kaaba. I mean, this is it could have fallen from heaven. I mean, the legend is that the stone of heaven fell from heaven, and it actually came out of Lucifer's crown when he was fighting with Saint Michael and fell to earth, and that's the original stone of heaven. Well, you know, from one perspective, Lucifer was a giant in heaven, and Michael was giant, and so his crown was giant. So when that stone fell from his crown, it was huge, and it became the what they call the Ibn Setia, the stone of foundation in Jerusalem. And so, you know, it ended up there during the earliest times of Earth's, you know, creation. So it's been there, you know, a long time. There's also other legends. There's the Persian legend of Al-Burz, which is actually a mountain that's supposed to be completely made out of emerald. And one of the legends about Lucifer is that the stone in his crown was an actual emerald. And so the Persians believe that that is the true stone of heaven. So, you know, for every tradition, you've got different ideas about what is the stone of heaven. You know.
Well, isn't that what the tablets of Thoth were made out of? Were emerald? Were they not emerald tablets?
Well, that's absolutely right. Yeah, and of course, the emerald, being the green, being the middle color, has an alchemical energy to it because it unites the polarity together. And I believe that just by sitting in proximity to that tablet, and you can imagine it's this huge emerald tablet. Just by sitting in proximity to that, it would actually stimulate the process of awakening of the Kundalini and alchemical unfoldment just by sitting in front of it. You know, so there's no question why emerald would have been used to create that tablet that had the 13 precepts of alchemy written on it. You know?
Well, is that the root of the knowledge of the Templars, or do they predate the tablets of Thoth?
Well, it's hard to predate the tablet of Thoth because basically Thoth is kind of a manifestation of this being in the East, this first Kundalini master, if you will. He's one manifestation of him in the West, because Thoth is both, he's the divine mind, but he's also the transformative fire, if you will. As Thoth, he's the divine mind. As Hiram or Chiram, he's the transformative fire. He's the master builder of the Freemasons, that Kundalini that rebuilds your body, you know. And so basically, he's just a manifestation of that energy in the East that started that whole Holy Grail tradition, you know. So they couldn't really predate him. He's been around forever.
Right, right. Well, are the tablets emerald or are they moldavite?
I would say emerald.
Okay.
Because that's what you find over and over again in the traditions. They talk about them as being emerald. And if they were meteorite, I think they would have said meteorite, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that they really are an emerald.
Yeah, emerald's not that rare of a stone, of a jewel on this planet, but it is rare in big size.
Right. I mean, time and time again you hear that the original stone of heaven was an emerald that was lodged in Lucifer's crown, came loose when he fought Archangel Michael, and then fell to Earth. And so I think that the original stone, the original Holy Grail stone on this plane, I think it really was emerald. You know, and I think maybe it did become the tablet of Hermes.
So do you think that tablet, holding those secrets of maybe how to rebuild a world after cataclysms, do you think that's where the original root of the Templar wisdom came from?
I think if you're going to go back far enough, I think that it's Hermes, he's an archetypal energy. You see, he's the energy of alchemy. He is energy. He is alchemy. You know, I mean he and his tablet, he and the process of alchemy. He is that energy. He is that alchemical energy. Just like, hello?
Yeah.
We have a caller on the line, and maybe you can give us your first name and where you're calling from.
I'm calling from Northern California, and I am M. Card, who has emailed you quite a few times.
Oh, yes. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
I just found out the other day that you're in Kentucky, so I can't very well come and see you unless I can teleport. Well, I'd love to get together with you somehow, but I don't know how, just to talk in our Earth stuff.
Yeah, well, do you have a question for our guest, Mark Pinkham?
To tell you the truth, I just came in the house and knew you'd be on the radio, and I haven't been listening. What is he talking about?
Well, bless your heart. We're talking about the book Guardians of the Holy Grail, and we're talking about Thoth and all kinds of ancient mysteries, and yes, even the inner earth. So if you've got a real quick question, you can lay it on us, and we'll do our best to answer it.
Well, when Admiral Byrd went in, he was not allowed to speak about what he did, and apparently that after he died, his son has written a book about it. And I wanted you to feel secure about these beings being beautiful that are there within the in the inner earth, and so not to be afraid. And what is the? I mean, I'm kind of ancient. Any chance of going on that trip?
Well, there's always a chance, you know.
Yes,
even though this is a nuclear-powered icebreaker.
Yes.
It is somewhat very comfortable. It has a swimming pool on the inside, and you don't have to go outside in the 20 below winds and the 120-foot seas.
Well, one question I wanted to ask you is, did you read The Smoky God, that
yes.
book? You did?
Yes, of course.
Oh, you did. Okay, good. I'm glad you did. So you're feeling perfectly secure. Well, I won't keep your time, but I'm just happy to hear you and hope that sometime I can talk to you, really.
Well, next time I'm out in California, I'll definitely let you know in advance, and we
will
can
you?
Get together.
Yeah. Okay. You email me.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll come to you. I'll come to you. I mean, I'm 84, so don't be afraid of me. I'm okay. But I still drive, and so I would definitely come to wherever you are.
Quite all right. Thank you very
much
for the phone call.
Yes. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, Mark, every once in a while, I you never know where the calls are going to come from, and that's just fine. You guys can call anywhere from in the world, toll-free U.S., toll-free Canada, or even off-planet or inside the planet. If you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us. The phone numbers are on the front page of bbsradio.com or X-squared radio at x2-radio.com, and my guest is Mark Pinkham, and we were talking about Thoth and the Emerald Tablets and the roots of the Templars.
Right.
And I was going to ask you a question. What does it mean to be alchemically active in the body?
Well, that means basically having to awaken that inner energy. I mean, my whole path, way before I got involved with Templars, has been involved with awakening that energy. I was in India when I was 21 and living in an ashram there that was headed by a guru, a master, a teacher. That the whole path started when he transmitted some of his power, his kundalini power inside of you and awakened your energy. And so I was seeing all around me all the time and experiencing, you know, the awakened kundalini and all the different manifestations of it. And certainly when it is awakened, it does all the work of transforming you on all different levels. And one of the first manifestations of it is a distinct sort of a fire, because anytime it encounters any blockage on any level, it burns through it, you know. So you can feel a lot of heat in your body. You can also feel like there's kind of a thumping or an ache around your coccyx, base of your spine, where that energy is awakened. I mean, these are the first manifestations. You get, you might get psychic visions, and you might get different other manifestations as the different chakra centers become open. But ultimately, it leads to gnosis. You start knowing things that you didn't know before. They just kind of happen within you. You just kind of wake up to the truth, you know, and you just know it to be the truth. And
well, how does this awakening begin? You said you were on a path. And, you know, we have 12 million listeners over a week's period that are going to hear this, some people sitting at their computers on Monday morning. How would they awaken it? Do they have to go to Sri Lanka to do it?
No. They don't have to go anywhere. You just look at the Pentecostal church, some of these charismatic Christian churches. I mean, they call forth the Holy Spirit, right? Come into me, awaken me, bless me, you know. work through me. Well, the Holy Spirit is just a manifestation of the Kundalini in the West. And they start, what do they start doing? They start writhing in their seats, and they start speaking in tongues. These are all manifestations that I saw in the East, in India, when with people with Kundalini awakening. It's the same thing. So it can happen anywhere. A lot of it depends on, well, according to the Masters in the East, your own destiny. If you are destined to get that energy awakened this year, this lifetime, it's going to happen. And if you're destined to do it, it's going to happen any place. And it can happen spontaneously any place. It could happen many different environments, many different circumstances. For example, people come to Sedona, and they get their Kundalini activated here. Because of the strong power of the vortexes, it's amplified by the red rocks, which are full of iron, which are full of crystal. It's just like a gigantic meteorite sitting on top of the vortexes here. That's one way of doing it. But a lot of people get it naturally awakened by getting very much involved with yoga and meditation practices. You know, day in and day out, they are practicing their yoga, and spontaneously at some point it awakens. Or this is also very common in their dream state. You know, what comes is a huge serpent. It comes and bites them on the finger, or bites them someplace in the body, or maybe enters their body. And at that point, that energy is awakened because it's a serpentine energy. So there's many ways of doing it, just through the repetition of mantras, sacred syllables. Mantras in the East are of the Sanskrit language, a very sacred language that will vibrate in that root chakra, vibrate in that base of the spine and awaken Kundalini. But it's believed that the safest way of getting that energy awakened is through a master, like I did, because the master, at that point, once he or she awakens that energy within you, they can control it, they can guide it up the spine. And some people have some very wild experiences. They see things that, you know, they make them feel like they're going crazy, you know, and they can't handle it. But if you have a guru, then the guru or the master can control the Kundalini and protect them or take them out of that kind of experience if it gets to be too crazy for them or more than they can handle, you see. So it really, that's the best thing is to have, in my mind, is to have a master, not try to do it on your own. But, of course, masters are everywhere. The vibration of masters are on different levels. They're everywhere. And so if you were really sincere and you want that energy awakened, you can do that anytime, any place.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
This is Jehala, and I'm calling from Tennessee.
I'm
neighbors to you.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Welcome aboard.
I'm that girl, if I ever get my behind in gear, we'll be doing the show People in Fur Coats on BBS.
<Yeah.
laughs> Anyway, I was talking to another talk show host on BBS this afternoon, and he was really kind of at a loss. And since this seems to be your expertise, what's it, sir, could I catch your name again? I'm sorry.
Not you,
Dr. Brooks. Your guest. What's your name?
Mark Pinkham. He's the author of Guardians of the Holy Grail, The Knights Templar, John the Baptist, and The Water of Life.
Wow. Yeah, I just tuned in. I kind of missed the first hour of the show, but what I've been listening
to
in the last 30 minutes is very intriguing. But I have a case myself, and I'm going to share it with you if you'll indulge me a minute, that's happened to me in the last 48 hours that's really strange. But maybe because this is, Mark, your expertise, you might be able to put some clarification on this.
I'll see what I can do.
Yesterday morning,
I love it.
I awoke, and I'm very clairvoyant, very spiritual. A lot of people tell me this. I think they think I'm more than I think I am, but that's neither here nor there. Always have been able to know and sense when things were going to happen. It was getting people to believe it was the problem. Because, you know, we always get blowed off as woo-woos. But anyway, maybe that time is changing. But when I awoke yesterday morning, all of a sudden this knowledge had been downloaded into my mind about our off-world ships. And I understood at that point exactly how they operate on the reverse electromagnetics. And actually, it's been so fast, the reverse magnetics, that it creates a vortex inside where the ship is at. And that's why you'll actually find that when you're inside the ship, even though it's spinning at these unbelievable rates, you have stability within the inside of that ship. And what was shown to me was that it's the same concept of our hurricanes and our tornadoes. Inside the vortex is calm and quiet while you have all this rotation outside. Now, I'm not an engineer. I don't have anything to do with that. I don't know why all this was shown to me. I could go into a lot more detail, but that's enough for the show tonight. So then when I got up, this is what I woke up to. I went in the bathroom and to wash my face, and I look on my forehead. Now, I have an indentation in my third eye. I have had since I was a little girl.
Uh-huh.
But inside that indentation, I have the perfect mark of a pyramid. It's outlined in red now. It doesn't go away. It's been there for 2 days.
Wow.
Does anybody want to help me with this?
Yeah, what do you think happened? Do you think that you were shown something, or do you think your third eye opened up and saw something?
I think I might have had an off-world experience. It's not the first time they've come and got me.
Wow.
Hopefully the white coats don't come and get me tonight for saying that.
Well, it sounds like to me, if you want, you know, my input, that obviously you've got some special connection to some extraterrestrial culture, and they are revealing a lot of information to you. Those kind of things just don't come out of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously you've been given some special information for some reason, and if you don't know what it is, I'm sure it'll be revealed to you in the future, because they wouldn't just give you that information for no reason and just let you go. And I've been downloaded with information like that myself, and sometimes it's been kind of confusing at first, but then eventually you realize, you know, why you were given it and what the purpose of it is. So my suggestion to you is just hang in there, and you'll know what to do with it. That circumstances will arise that you'll be able to use that.
What I just explained to you about the vortexes and the anti-gravity spinning, because you are a scientist, does any of that make any sense to you?
Well, it does a little bit. I did some calculations on black holes in the first book of The Arc of Millions of Years, and we talk about that. The physics community for, I don't know, the last 20 years has been fairly convinced that that black holes exist, and
mm-hmm.
that maybe they lead to wormholes, and that wormholes are supported on the inside by exotic material, which is made from neutron stars. But the calculations show that that kind of wormhole collapses in on itself actually before it's even formed. So I went back to the drawing board and sort of came up with the same thing that you did, that black holes are actually made of spinning matter around
mm-hmm.
the inside of the event horizon, but leaving a void in the center.
Which is the
problem. However,
mm-hmm.
it's a very strong gravitational, like tornado hole,
yes.
a wormhole.
Yeah.
And that those things can be stable for millions, perhaps billions of years, and they actually make windows between dimensions or different areas of the universe, and craft or even planets can use these to move from dimension to dimension or across parsecs of space. But that's just a theory, but it sure seems to fit with your dream really well.
That's what they were wanting to show me, was that's how they're able to navigate and get here in the timely fashions that they do from light years away. And to the better way to explain for us, because we're in 3D right here right now, is that they gave me the vision of the tornado circular spin and the calm vortex inside. That's what it was.
Wow.
Because I had asked the question.
I'm glad you called.
Hmm?
I'm glad you called.
Yeah, thank you, dear.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, Mark, getting back to her question and your comment and something that you said about a download, I've had my own experience, which I don't want to go and take up a whole bunch of time tonight, but you can always go back and listen to archives and hear it. But I got a download, much like what you're talking about, and it didn't make any sense to me at the time, and as time goes on, little bits and pieces of that become clearer and clearer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that happened to you as well?
Yeah, I did, actually. It was some years ago when I was heavily into crystals, and at the time, everyone wanted to acquire their own what they call record keeper, because these are special crystals that were planted that were supposed to be full of this ancient wisdom. And I found one that had all the markings of a record keeper, and I kept it near my bed at night. And at night I would have these incredible dreams of flying saucers and extraterrestrials and things. And
are they special markings?
Well, you know, it was more like, you know, I couldn't really remember that much when I woke up. It was almost like, well, one dream that I had, it was actually the spaceship kind of entered inside me, and from that point on, I felt a lot more of a connection to extraterrestrials, and it kind of prepared me for my shamanic studies down in Peru. I apprenticed with the shaman down there for 3 years, and we used a kind of a cactus to awaken our consciousness, and he believed that cactus actually came from Venus, and every time that he did it, he would have these encounters with Venusians, and so I've had a couple encounters myself, and I felt very much more connected. I'm sure I felt a lot more connected to them than I would if I hadn't had that original experience with the crystal. You know.
So were there markings on the crystal itself?
Yeah, there was a pyramid marking on a crystal, you know, just like when she talked about, you know, pyramid over a third eye or triangle over a third eye. It was kind of similar sort of markings, yeah, which is interesting.
Well, I was going to just toss this in here. It happened last night. I had a dream, or maybe it was early this morning, I don't know, but I had a dream that I was walking along and there was a snake in the grass, and it was rather thick and rather long, and I couldn't tell whether it was poisonous or not. So I asked the person who was standing next to me, "What is that snake?" And they said, "Well, it's just a boa, so it's not going to be poisonous, but they do have teeth, and it had very strange markings on its back, like a figure eight, and then some kind of question mark underneath it, and I didn't know what it was. But I had a stainless steel blade in my hand, so I just kind of waved it over the snake, and it went away. I have no idea what it meant."
Well, my take on that is that the Native Americans, and actually other people around the planet, they think that the snakes are actually physical manifestation of pure energy. And pure energy has a code attached to it. You know, at the beginning of time, pure energy was created with a certain code, and that code was basically the formula of the evolution of energy from that point on, right? And so actually physical snakes give you a lot of information about the unfoldment of energy from the very beginning of time, and about energy in general. Well, the Mayans and the tribes in Central America, they took some of the geometrical forms and designs on rattlesnakes, and they created their whole entire calendars around that, because those calendars, all calendars are all about the unfoldment of energy, and so they learned about all cycles of unfoldment through studying the back of the geometrical formations on the back of rattlesnakes, and they designed their whole calendars around that.
Well, I know that the Ouroboros is a sort of a serpent dragon that swallows its
well,
own
that's
tail.
Well, that's it. That's the symbol of how the cycles keep going, and at some point he devours his own tail. So he actually destroys himself, and then he becomes reborn. So energy is destroyed, and then it's reborn in the new cycle.
Sort of like the
So you could be actually been shown some information about energy. But what was the symbol you said you saw? What was that
symbol?
Well,
it looked like maybe the infinity symbol, and then underneath it was kind of a, I don't know, looked like a question mark or an S or something like that, but it was on the snake's back.
Mm-hmm.
I thought,
well,
that's
of course
a really strange marking.
All right. Well, of course, affinity symbol is also the symbol of eight, symbol of alchemy, which is a point in the evolution of matter. Eight is the point. Eight is the point when the upper world, lower world comes together, polarity unites together in one. when heaven and earth meet, heaven meets earth in this cycle of nine, right? Because after that happens, then the nine comes, which is the end of the cycle. Because in eight, you basically completed the cycle, and the nine, you can leave this plane, you know. So it's describing that particular stage. This is why eight is also the symbol of alchemy, by the way, because eight is also a symbol of the infinity. And through the union of the polarity, you become immortal, you become infinite.
Wow, it's strange that you should use those words, because in both volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years, we have a chapter called The Union of the Polarity, and we talk about that very thing. It's just very strange to hear someone else say it. It's very cool. Well, listen, I want to go back to just as we finish up this second hour. We were talking about crystals or stones. I've heard people say that when crystals are placed on the back of the body, that they actually move the alchemical force in the body that you call the kundalini, from the base of the spine to the top of the head. How is this accomplished? How do crystals and various stones interact with the energy of the human body?
Well, basically, if you're going to awaken Kundalini, you have to basically move it at its level. As I mentioned with the meteorites, the meteorites work on the electromagnetic field, as will all stones. You know, they'll work on the electromagnetic field. But if you move the energy on one level, you're going to move it on other levels. This is why if you heal somebody on a physical level, you're also healing them on other levels. Stuff on other levels that needs to be healed is going to come up, right? And so this is the level that Kundalini exists in, the etheric body, is very closely connected to the electromagnetic field. So if you move the energy in one, you can often move the energy in the other. And this is also what's known as the prana body. This is the body of meridians that the acupuncturists work with, and this is or called the nadis in India, the subtle energy vessels that prana, the chi, flows within. It's the same body, because the kundalini is actually a chi, it's a prana, it's a life force, it's a higher frequency of that, generally, you know. It's a more conscious frequency, you might say, with a specific purpose, you know, that it goes ahead and does when it's awakened. But certainly crystals, the good thing about crystals is that they're either single terminated or double terminated, and so you can direct the energy in accordance to the determination, you know, and this is why, you know, crystals are often used. But they also have kind of a fiery energy associated with them, and you'll find that this is why the shamans use them. They can be very fiery, very, very active energy. On the subtle level, they're made of tetrahedrons, it said, you know, and that's kind of one of the five platonic solids associated with fire. And so it has that fiery energy already. And so the fire itself of the crystal in some way can go to awaken your inner fire, which is kundalini energy, you see. So there's many ways of looking at that. Also, that the termination, the top part of the crystal, oftentimes is the same angle as the angle of the Great Pyramid, you know. And the Great Pyramid generates fire within. It's a pyramid, fire in the middle, you know. And this is why it was used as an initiation chamber. You go in there, you're surrounded by fire, and awakens your own fire. So there's a number of different ways that a crystal can awaken the fire, awaken kundalini, as you can see.
Well, I never thought about the word pyramid meaning fire in the middle, but I see it now that you say it.
Right, exactly. Well, it's uniting the polarity together. In the ancient times, the triangle is often represented as spirit. It's the Trinity, and then the square, of course, is matter, and uniting. Spirit and matter together, heaven and earth together, and by doing that, you are generating the life force. What you're doing, basically, is you are accelerating the frequency of matter to that of fire. And so you're creating that fiery energy within, which is also prana, which is also chi, which is why they put the sarcophaguses there, because the prana of the chi will preserve the mummies better that way, you see.
Well, I heard that they didn't actually bury people in the Pyramid of Giza, that was actually a place where an ascension initiation took place. They put you in this...
Well, you're absolutely true. You're absolutely right. They never found They never actually found a mummy in any of the pyramids in Egypt. they were all initiation chambers. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, you just were exposed to concentrated amounts of male energy or white energy.
Right. Yeah, I mean it was full of that fire, if you will, that Kundalini fire, and the priests of Osiris, who facilitated the initiation, he would speak the words of Thoth, and Thoth is, of course, he's the fire himself. He is the divine mind and the fire himself, which would go to essentially activate that energy. Elizabeth Hake, I guess her name, wrote that book on initiation, where she remembered her past life and Egypt when she went through that initiation, and she was in the sarcophagus of the Great Pyramid, and there was this priest over her chanting these the words of Thoth, and she had that typical Kundalini activation, and that's what happens. We've actually been in the King's Chamber a number of times, and we have people in the sarcophagus, and they've had classical Kundalini activations within that sarcophagus.
Wow!
So it does work as an initiation chamber. Yeah.
I heard they actually moved the sarcophagus off of its original location to keep that Fibonacci spiral from focusing right on the sarcophagus, just because people would get in the darn thing and have these sort of out-of-body experiences.
Well, let me tell you this. People are still having them, because I had one myself. Still have them. Yeah. They must not have moved it enough, because people still have these amazing experiences.
Oh, I definitely want to hear about that in the next hour. I know here on X Squared Radio, we go places that most hosts don't go, but we just kind of go with the flow, with where we're inspired. I love your book, and we're sort of pacing our way through the book, but you are the book, really, Mark, and we're trying to get you to
right.
To come alive. You've already made a world exclusive here, that world peace, that whole paradox is about to be cracked open in the next 6 months through bringing all these religious leaders, and I don't think there's anyone that listens to this program that thinks that all of the wars in this world aren't religious basis right now.
Well, of course, and, yeah. Well, there was no mistakes, and for whatever reason, I was, meant to come on and announce it today. So it was for you and everybody who's listening.
Wow. Well, fantastic. In the last 3 minutes of this hour, we do have a caller on the line, another one. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
I'm sorry. This is Gail back. You guys were talking about the Kundalini. And
yeah.
Were you guys aware that back in March of 2006, shortly, at the Body, Mind, and Spirit Expo in San Diego, there's a gentleman that was there named Renan Shahar. He's the founder of the New Dawn Clinic, and he had just came from Switzerland. And they do a process called Atlas Prophylax that realigns the top spinal vertebrae, and it's the C1, or it's called the Atlas 1. And they said 99% of all humans, that this thing, this C1 vertebrae is out of alignment, and it blocks the Kundalini from being able to go up the spine totally to the brain, to the third eye. And upon manipulating that with some kind of a probing thing, they use chiropractic terms. There are some doctors now being trained to realign this. But they said statistically, this C1 or Atlas vertebrae, it's impossible for it to have this displacement. It's not a simple result of physical trauma. And they believe that when, there's the stories about the Anunnaki creating humans, to do slave labor and all that, that this might perhaps be how they blocked us from having a full Kundalini awakening. And I'm just curious, Mark, if you've heard anything about that.
I haven't really, but the tradition I come out of is that when the Kundalini is awakened, it does everything that it needs to do in order to make its path clear so that it can rise up to the top of the head, the Sahasra 1,000-petal lotus. And so if it needs to make any correction in the cervical spine, it would do that. So perhaps it's true, and perhaps that the Kundalini does that work on its own when it is awakened. So, but no, specifically about that, I haven't heard that.
Okay. Yeah, I found that really interesting. You can read more about it by going to www.goingdeeper.org.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank
all right.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
thank
we
you.
Appreciate that. Well, listen, it's that time again, so we're going to take about a 7-minute break, and we'll be back after these messages with my very excellent guest, Mark Pinkham, and we're going to have more firsts right here on X Squared Radio, so don't go away. We'll be back.
Smelling mighty good in here. No, I think we're going to go right to sex.
Since ancient times,
what?
Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of
Brooks
millions.
Agnew, X Squared Radio.
Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the Temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can this week.
Talked about the conferences.
Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio. Join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th.
Yeah, right. Could let him... Huh?
Shalimar Productions was created from a vision to bring to Mount Shasta the
masters
who are out there on the front lines helping to awaken a sleeping humanity. From July 12th through August 12th, you can watch this dream unfold through three great conferences, including workshops. Nikhil Ledwick, William Henry, Sherry Faria, David Carmel, as well as David Icke and others will offer you their wisdom and experience. This is just a sample of the life-changing knowledge you can gain by clicking on the Shalimar Productions banner at X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the shining ones who lived on the earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Think it's possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjets. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. Statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, my friends, to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew, and in here is where the past meets the future, and the results are always positive. Wanted to let you know, last week we were talking about the rumor of a galactic wave striking Earth coming March 9th. Gee, it looks like that date already passed, and we were right here on X Squared Radio again. There was no truth, in fact, to the galactic wave that was coming to Earth, going to cause 300-mile-an-hour winds. And if you just think about it, just use your heads, folks. There's no way that a galactic wave can be measured from this planet with any kind of warning, because the fastest detective force we have travels at the speed of light, and a galactic wave made of gravity is going to travel at least 20,000 times the speed of light. Not going to be able to bounce a wave off that and tell anything about it before it's too late. And I know we keep telling you this, but I feel compelled to tell you again, please visit NitroPack at X Squared Radio and at least start the process of getting your emergency preparedness supplies together. Yes, we could say nothing and just take care of ourselves, but that's not what we're about here. We're trying to keep you aware of what you should be doing and what you could be doing to help yourselves. And if you resonate with that, then help yourself now while times are good. You may never need it, but it never hurts to be prepared. So go ahead and click on the banner. We're here to explore the mysteries of the universe. You are here to help affect the universe with your great talents. You are absolutely perfect, just the way you are, but you're not complete. You should be grateful for what you have and the talents that you have. Don't forget to dream. My guest tonight is Mark Pinkham, and we're having an absolutely fabulous discussion. His book is called Guardians of the Holy Grail, The Knights Templar, John the Baptist, and the Water of Life. And Mark, one more time, could you give us a couple of websites, not just for your book, but other things you're doing?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, it's www.gnostictemplars.org will take you to the website of the International Order of Gnostic Templars that I'm the North American Grand Prior of now, and talk about our conferences and all about our order and how to get initiated. And you can even download an application if you're interested. And we also have www.bodymindspiritjourneys.com, and those are the tours that I lead. They're all Gnostic Templar sort of tours around the world. And there's also www.serpentsofwisdom.com. That was my original website. My original book that I wrote was called The Return of the Serpents of Wisdom. Some of you out there might recognize that title. But it talks about the work that I do is a lot of my shamanic work and alchemical and astrological work. So there's three good websites there.
And we'll make sure to put those websites on X Squared Radio so you can reach them when you go to the archives to listen to this. Many of you listen on Monday or Tuesday. I think Monday's our highest listening day. We have lots and lots of people go to work Monday morning all over the world, and they listen to X Squared Radio. And they'll hear about Mark Pinkham. And if you don't pick that up, just or remember it in the audio, just go to X Squared Radio and click on the links. We'll have bodymindspirit.com and serpentsofwisdom.com added to Mark Pinkham's bio there in the archives. And those of you that are subscribers can listen to that. And if you're not a subscriber, please, it only takes about $2.50 a month if you want to do it month by month, and $1.67 a month. I mean, come on, that's cheaper than a cup of coffee. You could listen to X Squared Radio for a year. There are almost 200 hours of great archives in there, and now Mark Pinkham's going to be added to that. And I think Mark and I are going to do some other things together. I think I'm going to go to Sri Lanka, and I'm extending an invitation to him to join our expedition to the North Pole in the fall. And we'll see how things work out. Mark, I had a couple questions. One, you mentioned that if you're looking for crystals, the one that you found had a pyramid on it. But what, I mean, there are a lot of rock shops out. I mean, Sedona's famous for them, and we've got them in where I'm at here and in Kentucky. And, you know, it just seems like a bunch of tumbled rocks sometimes. What should we look for in a real crystal that might resonate with us?
Well, that's a good question, Brooks. That's actually part of what I do. I'm a Vedic astrologer, and when you get your Vedic chart done, it tells you exactly what stones are best for you, your true birthstones. I tend to subscribe more to the Vedic system than the Western system of astrology because I think it's more accurate, and it's based on the sidereal zodiac, which I think is more accurate than the tropical zodiac we observe here in the West. But these stones that are right for you, if you wear them, they're going to strengthen your physical body. They're going to strengthen your personality. They're going to help you to fulfill your destiny here on Earth. And besides that, there's also stones that are associated with the lucky houses in your chart. And if you wear those stones, it'll bring forth all the lucky events associated with those houses. And also, everybody throughout their life, they are, at any given point in time, they are moving through a cycle that's ruled over by a certain planet. Now, you might be in your Jupiter cycle, I might be in my Saturn cycle, but if you wear stones ruled by Jupiter, it's going to help you. It's going to support you in moving through your Jupiter cycle. So there's three or four different stones that people should be wearing all the time.
Wow. Well, I wear malachite because I have, well, I just have gifts that people talk about, and they do seem to manifest from time to time. So I wear a malachite in my necklace. But when you talk about the zodiac, are you talking about, Aries and Pisces and Gemini?
I'm talking about your ascendant, which is going to be one of the 12 signs. But mainly it's the planet that rules over your ascendant, that rules over the different stones that you should be wearing.
For example, malachite's
ruled over by Mercury, which is Hermes, which is both, which is an alchemical stone, and it's also associated with the fifth ray in the Gnostic world. We're Gnostics, and so this is another way we look at it, that every one of us is aligned with one of the seven rays, and we've got lords of those seven rays that are assisting us and supporting us in this world. And if you are wearing a fifth ray stone, like a green stone, you will have Hermes that will be more there and accessible to you to assist you in your work. And certainly if you're an alchemist, that's what you want.
Well, I wouldn't fight off alchemy right now. Putting on an expedition of this size, I was I was part of the expedition as just a contributing scientist last year, and then unfortunately our expedition leader died last summer, and I was elected to lead, and so last September I was just sort of handed the reins, and since that time I've tried to put together the best team that I can, and of course raise the funding, the rest of the funding needed to go, and we've been somewhat successful in that, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, maybe you could tell me how you came up with your funding. I'm working on trying to get drum up the funding I need for Sri Lanka right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know what you mean. There's plenty of money out there.
There is. It's just a matter of how to draw it to you. Yeah.
Yep. And I recently took Merkaba meditation training, and I've learned a little bit about how to manifest from our own consciousness those things that we mm-hmm. we want and that we need. And I'm getting better at it, it seems, because things are beginning to turn. And we've been somewhat successful with private donations, and we've made some really good presentations to different producers. But, of course, one expedition this size is way, way too large for even the cable channels like Discovery or History to do. This is way out of their budget. They're into
right.
the $100,000 documentaries, not the $1 million documentaries. So this is... It's going to be done with private funds, and that's a good reason why no one's ever done this expedition before, because, you know, it's not easy. This is going to be very hard, but we like doing hard things. We like doing the impossible, and Explore Radio has beat the odds many, many times.
Well, if it's meant to happen, if it's time to happen, it's going to fall into place, and even if you resist it, it's going to fall into place, so...
Yep. Well, that's what we find out. Now, I want to ask you about your experience in the sarcophagus at the pyramid, if you want to talk about it.
Sure, yeah. Well, it was actually the first time that I was in the sarcophagus. That was some years ago when Andrea, my wife, and I were on a site inspection tour in Egypt, and... So it was just us together checking out the different sites and hotels and so forth. And
so you weren't part of a tour group, right? You were
no, it was, just, it was just the two of us, yeah.
I find those are better, don't you?
Oh, this was fabulous. I mean, they rolled out the red carpet wherever we went. And we were able to be in the King's Chamber by ourselves for 45 solid minutes, which was very nice. And so we both took turns in the sarcophagus and... my experience right away was that it was almost like the, you know, you think of these planes that drop the bombs, the bottom kind of opens up and the bomb falls out of the bottom of the plane.
Oh, like
that's
kind of
how it felt.
Door
it felt like, yeah, that's kind of how it felt, like the sarcophagus opened up its bottom doors and I was the bomb that it emitted, you know. I was just kind of finding myself floating in space. And there I was, and... for some time. I mean, it was very incredible, really.
Did you hear anything?
Yeah, I think that, but that wasn't the significance so much of it. The significance was that I was out of my body, and apparently that is the reason that the ancient Egyptians put the initiates through their initiation in the sarcophagus, because they would leave their body. They would leave their body. They would be their ba, their spirit body. They would fly around the chamber, or even fly out of the pyramid, right, and then come back. And that revealed to them that they weren't their physical body, you know, that they were something greater, that they were actually, you know, immortal. And so that was that experience, you know, the classic experience of just becoming the ba, becoming the soul body, and just flying through the universe that way, and then knowing that, you know, I'm not the physical body. And
is that something that you expected to happen, or were you just kind of open to anything?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've been meditating for a long time, and I've been having a lot of astral travel experiences for a long time, too, and traveling in different universes and so forth that way. But what did change me, and I'm not sure I can even put my finger on it, but when Andrew and I left the pyramid that day, we'd known that we'd gone through initiation. We could just feel it, and things started accelerating our lives, and in our lives, when we returned to them, were definitely different in some ways. But, so I don't think you can go into the the King's Chamber and lay in the sarcophagus without really going through an initiation. It's just going to happen on some level, you know, to everybody.
Did you, you had already written books before this, but did you find your creative abilities, your abilities to write and communicate and visualize, did you find those changed from that day forward?
They might have been enhanced a bit, yeah. But, you know, the first day when we arrived in Egypt, we were given a room in the Mina House, which is a hotel right next to the Great Pyramid, and we had a porch attached to our room that looked right on to the Great Pyramid, and so immediately that's where I went and just hung out there and meditated on the Great Pyramid, and I could feel my third eye just go wide open, and I started receiving all this information, and my wife can tell you that I was going nuts running back and forth into the room trying to find scraps of paper to write it all down on. And a lot of that information became... some of the information in my third book, you know, and but it was just pouring right into me. So my belief is, you don't even have to go inside the Great Pyramid, you know, to have these experiences or to get your third eye open or to feel the effects of the pyramid. You don't even have to go inside of it and you'll be changed. You just have to be, you know, within its energy field and it'll change you.
Well, I am excited. I'm going to Egypt in October for 14 days with my friend Maureen St. Germain and her group. I don't know how large the group is going to be, but it's going to be good.
Are you going into the King's Chamber then?
Yeah, we're going into the King's Chamber. We're going to Denderos and Abydos and try to. I don't know how much we're going to tour, but it's definitely a hectic schedule. And I'm looking forward to it. I've never been there, and I just want to experience it.
Oh yeah, you'll love it. It's amazing. I mean, it's always hectic there because there's so much to see in such little time. But it's amazing, especially Abydos, where you've got a temple there that's the architecture is like no place else in all of Egypt, and they've dated that back to like 11,000 BC, I guess.
Yeah. Well, isn't there a race called the Hathors that I think there are statues there of those? What do you know about
well,
the
Hathor? Well, yeah. Well, they were a race that came from Venus, but there were a number of different races that came from Venus. This particular race had to do with sound vibration specifically, you know, and this is why you have Hathor, the goddess of sound and dance and singing and so forth, and Dendera. So they were specifically related to that, just like, you know, they were, that's the cow goddess, and of course the cow was Taurus and the zodiac, and Taurus was over the throat singing and dancing. It's very, you know, very playful sort of energy. So some people were very much aligned with the Hathors. I mean, my old friend of mine, Tom Kenyon, for example, one of the best toners on the planet, and he started channeling the Hathor some time ago. So they opened him up, and they teach him the secrets of sound healing. You know, so that's what they're all about. And certainly, I'm sure their energy is still there at Dendera, and you can still encounter them if that is your work, and that's what you're supposed to be doing is opening yourself up to those vibrations, and maybe perhaps teaching those vibrations to others.
So the Hathors were a playful race? I mean, they had fun? They came here for fun?
Well, they were, yeah, essentially. They were apparently kind of a joyous sort of a race.
Well, that sounds awesome to me. I don't like the conquerors or the gold slavers. I like the idea that people just travel around and share their songs and their dances like the Indians and just
well, then
fun.
You'll love Dendera because that's what it was all about there. I mean, Hathor was, she was Venus. You know, she was the goddess of Venus, and so Venus was, you know, about playful. It was passion, certainly sexual passion. They did sexual tantra there, I guess, right there in the temple. But it was Venus is all about beauty and harmony. You see, Venus rules over song and dance and art and all those, you know, beautiful things. And of course, love. And so maybe you'll find your place when you go to Dendera. Maybe you'll find your deity in Hathor.
In the ceiling, I might be just way off here because I haven't been there. But in the ceiling, isn't there a relief that's got some Vedic craft? The Vimana, are they not? I don't know. It might be not those buildings, but I know I'm in the right country at least.
Yeah, right. I think it's Abydos, I think, actually. I don't know about them being Vimana. I think that I've seen a couple of those released, and it looks like they've actually got wings. They kind of look more like rockets, I think, actually, than actual, you know, spaceships or you know, not so much like discs, more like rockets or airplanes or something.
Yeah, I thought one looked like a Black Hawk helicopter.
Yeah, something like that. I think it's an Abydos, actually. Yeah, I think you'll find that there, yeah.
Well, that's really exciting. Now, we might have covered this in the first hour, but I want to try to cover this because I've had some people tell me that Osiris really didn't exist, that he was just a philosophy or a religion. But what is your knowledge of Osiris?
Osiris is a principle. He's a netter. You know, I mean, he's a principle. He's an archetypal principle. All the gods and goddesses of Egypt, they were netters. They were principles of nature. You know, and Osiris was basically the lord of nature. He was the green man himself. And so he was the one that they called upon every spring to grow their crops. He was the one that was born in the spring and died in the fall. You know, and he was his death by Seth was in the fall. You know, and so the common people knew him as the lord of nature, but in the spiritual traditions they knew him as the archetypal initiate who died and was reborn. You know, during the time of Scorpio. But, you know, he was a true consciousness, just like the green man is a true consciousness. In fact, Osiris is another name for this master in the East that I've been talking about in Sri Lanka. This master is known as Al-Qadir, the green man in the Muslim tradition. He's basically the life force itself, the life force that condenses into the forms of nature in the spring, and then he dies in the fall. Now, way before you had the tradition of the god, and the son of the god who died and was reborn, you had the tradition of the goddess and her son did the same thing. He died in the fall and he was resurrected again in the spring. He continually went through this cycle of death and rebirth. And so Osiris and the green man of all these different traditions, he was the original son of the goddess. You see,
and
he predated the tradition of the son of the god by many thousands of years. In fact, I write about him in The Truth Behind the Christ Myth, because Jesus' myth is actually amalgamation of the original myth of being born of the Virgin and dying and being reborn. That's from the original tradition of the Son of the Goddess, and it started from the East. It came from the East, and it actually came from this master that I've been talking about in Sri Lanka. It actually originated with him.
I was going to ask you about, I've got an IMer who's asking me about the Islamic crescent and star, and they're saying something about submission to God. I don't really know what they're asking there, but what do you think? I think this is the origin of Islam.
Islam means submission to God. That's a definition behind it, but the crescent moon and the star, five-point star, represents the goddess itself. So actually, the whole Islamic tradition descended from the goddess tradition originally. It became patriarchal, certainly, later on. But originally, it was a goddess tradition. And the Sufis today, the masters of the Islamic tradition, are very much great lovers of the goddess. And that's one reason that the Templars became that way, from studying with the Sufis, you see. Mecca was originally a place where there was great goddess worship. You know, the stone that they worship that's in the Kaaba today, that's a meteorite, which in ancient times there was always associated with Venus. It was the symbol of the goddess, you know. So essentially you've got, you know, millions of Muslims going on their pilgrimage to Mecca all the time, and essentially they are worshiping this form of the goddess. In ancient times, that was a goddess. All Mecca was shrines dedicated to the goddess originally. So the whole Muslim tradition started with the goddess and affiliation of the goddess. That's why you have the crescent moon. The moon is the goddess in the universe, and you've got the five-pointed star, which is Venus. You know, which is another form of the goddess.
Wow, and this is where the power of the Kundalini was learned?
Hello?
This is where the power of the Kundalini was learned?
Well, from where? See, the power of the Kundalini was actually learned through the Venusian tradition.
Right.
The original sons of God. If you go to the east and you learn about this master, this Kundalini master I'm talking about, you'll find that he led the sons of God to this planet, and he taught the daughters of men. They were the original sons of God. They taught the daughters of men the different traditions, the secret traditions. One of which was alchemy, right? And the legend is that they came from Venus, and they brought their traditions, the esoteric traditions, the goddess traditions. Venus is the planet of the goddess. They brought the traditions of the goddess, one of which, and the most important one, was the awakening of that inner energy, which is the goddess energy, you see. And it all comes from Venus. And this passed down through many thousands of years with the symbol of Venus being the Ankh, which became the symbol of immortality, because the path of the alchemy leads to immortality, as well as the rose. The rose is a symbol of alchemy. And all the alchemical and Gnostic traditions, including the Rosicrucians and Templars and you name it, all were under the rose, sub rosa, you know. They were all under the rose, symbol of Venus, because they were alchemical traditions.
Wow. Now I see how all these symbols come together.
Right, exactly.
This opens up a whole about 3 more hour show here. Now, this tantra that you were talking about, this is important to the propagation of the Kundalini?
Well, tantra it takes many different forms, one of which is sexual tantra, but tantra is simply uniting the male-female principles together in order to create that essence, that kundalini, that fiery essence. You can do it by uniting the genders together, certainly, and uniting the polarity that way, or you can unite it by uniting the male-female hormones within your own body. You can unite it by uniting the fire and the water in your body. The fire resides in the heart. Water resides in the kidneys. The Taoists do it that way. You can unite the polarity just by crossing your legs and crossing your arms, because one the right side is male while the other side is female. There's many, many different ways to do it, but the tantras are these books that are full of these ways of how to unite the polarity together and activate the alchemical processes within the human body. You know?
Do you think this is how planets are created?
Well, certainly there has to be the union of the male-female principles in order for anything to be created, you know. And that is... It's basically, in the East, they have what they call Advaita philosophy, non-dual philosophy, in which they say that the original spirit was an infinite spirit, that when he went to create the universe, he became the goddess. He became energy. He became power. The goddess is the power and the wisdom of the god. And so they're always interconnected. They're one and the same. But the way that they are represented in the East is the god-goddess in this eternal embrace, you know. But, you know, in the East, they're saying you can't create anything unless you unite the polarity. That's why, you know, the genders can't create anything, you know, unless a male and a female come together. It's just the way it is. You know, what you're creating is you're creating the life force. You're creating life force. That's why if you say, well, you're uniting spirit and matter together, you're raising the frequency of matter to pure life force. And so in the spring, you know, you've got the body of the goddess as the world, and you've got the god as the sun that comes and fecundates or copulates with the goddess and sends his seed into the world, and bam, you've got the green man. You've got all the forms of nature, which is the green man, which is the sun of the god and goddess. You've got the life force as the green man. So yeah, I mean, you always have to unite the polarity together in order to create life in any form.
Now, a lot of people don't know what the green man is or where the green man can be found. Is this the green man that's carved into the ceiling at Roslyn Chapel?
Yeah, well, actually, he's everywhere in Roslyn Chapel. I think they counted like 103 green man heads in Roslyn Chapel. But anyway, the green man is a true consciousness, all right? Think about the sons of God and how the leader of the son of God became the great watcher, or, you know, some of the sons of God became the great watchers. So their eyes basically are everywhere at all times. Well, that is essentially the green man. And he will appear to you in nature as you're walking along, and all of a sudden, it's like all the flowers and leaves and trees and plants, they all open their eyes at the same time, and you see millions of eyes around you. That's one way that he manifests.
Wow.
And I'll tell you something that's rather unusual that most people don't know about, is that if you look at those eyes, you'll notice that they're not normal human eyes.
Yeah.
They're actually the eyes you see on peacock feathers.
Oh,
and then oftentimes if you look closely, you'll see that those eyes are actually connected to peacock feathers. All the different forms of nature turn into peacock feathers, and the peacock feathers unite as actual peacocks. Another name for the green man is the peacock angel, you see. It's everything merges in to become peacocks. It's a very unusual thing. But once you've seen it, you'll know that all you have to do is tweak your perception a little bit, and you can see it. It's very, very bizarre. But not many people know about that. And that's, well, what I've experienced in my shamanic path, you know.
I might have stumbled into it. I recently became a trustee and helped found a company called Phoenix Science Foundation, which is in the process of becoming a nonprofit to help bring new energy devices to market. But in drawing the logo, the phoenix normally has something like an eagle head, but we decided to put a peacock head on the phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, well, actually, he's as part of the revival of the goddess tradition, it's the revival of the son of the goddess, and he is the peacock angel. A lot of people are having experiences of peacock right now because of that, and we are in the midst of the revival of the goddess. Let me tell you one more thing about the peacock angel, you see, because when the sons of God came here and they taught the daughters of men the secret mysteries, right?
Right.
They were the mysteries of alchemy, the mysteries of evolution. And they set up schools of alchemy and yoga at the time, and eventually these schools became the schools of the Great White Brotherhood. But anyway, there were two leaders of the sons of God. One was Sanat Kumara, this master of the living in Sri Lanka. He's got his temples in Sri Lanka today. And then the other was Sananda. And Sananda, he's known as... he's taken many incarnations. The last one was Jesus, right, they say. But anyway, it was those two that set up these ancient schools of the mysteries. And after they'd set up the schools, they decided, well, you know, we're going to stick around. We've done a lot of work here. You know, we want to make sure that humans can really benefit from this. So they stuck it out, and they decided, well, we're going to oversee the unfoldment of human evolution here. And so Sananda at the time says, okay, I'll keep reincarnating and spreading the wisdom. And Sanat says, well, okay, but I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here. And I'm actually, you know, as strange as it sounds, he decided to merge his spirit with the spirit of this earth, you know, and that's when he became the green man. And from that point on, he became the great watcher, too. So he's watching over us every moment of every day. When you have that experience, you realize that... It's absolutely true, because one of the ways that he manifests is just as a peacock, right? That's one of his forms. And when you're in his realm, so to speak, everything turns into peacocks. It's because the earth is his physical body, and the whole world is basically a peacock. It's the wildest thing, you know.
Wow.
But that's a tradition that's just coming around now. The Azeri people in northern Iraq, the Kurds, they've known for thousands of years about the peacock angel. He's their main... their main deity, you know. And a lot of the masters and teachers throughout all through the East, they know about the peacock angel. We just don't know about him here because, you know, not too many people have seen him. But now that we have the revival of the goddess tradition, a lot more people are going to see him now.
I have another person who's instant messaged me and wants me to ask you if you know anything about the pyramid that's been found in Bosnia by Sam Osmanagic.
No, I have to say I haven't heard anything about that. And,
all right,
you know, I don't really want to comment on something I don't really know anything about, no.
Yeah, I think it's relatively new. I don't know. Sometimes they just send me messages and they want me to ask the guests, so I ask.
Sure, of course.
These schools of enlightenment, I understand one of the schools was called the School of Marys, and it's where Jewish women were taught how to be wives, not that they all became wives, but that maybe Mary Magdalene actually came from one of these schools.
Well, I think that that's probably true, but I think that she was definitely connected to the Essene tradition. John the Baptist, Jesus, John the Apostle, they were all born into the Essenes. You see, the Mandaeans, when they came from Sri Lanka, they when they came west, they merged with the Sumerians, the Persians, the Egyptians. Finally, they merged with the Essenes. And when they did that, they actually founded the branch of Essenes known as the Nazarenes or the Nazarenes. I mean, Nazarene in the Gnostic Gospels have nothing to do with Nazareth, absolutely. I mean, it actually means wise man. It doesn't mean a place. But they were born into the Nazarene or the Nazarene sect. And the people in this sect were the Kundalini masters. Nazarene comes from Nas. Its root is Nas, meaning serpent. These were the masters of the serpent energy, you see. And I believe that, if nothing else, Mary was definitely very much involved with that particular sect. And a lot of people think she was actually a direct disciple of John the Baptist, too. So she was, in a sense, could have been a co-disciple of Jesus.
Well, didn't the Essenes come from an earlier sect called the Tat Brotherhood?
Well, there was many different lines that contributed to the Essenes. There's no question. This was one line that contributed to them, which was the line of the Mandaeans. It was from the Mandaeans that the Essenes acquired the rituals around baptism, water baptism, for example.
Ah.
But there were many different lines that fed into the Essenes, certainly. Right.
Wow, outstanding stuff. I tell you, this is just utterly fascinating. And I guess what the most enlightening thing to me about it is that largely Western Christianity, for some reason, they've missed most of this, or they erased a lot of it. It just seems very evangelical, but it doesn't seem to have these ancient roots that you're talking about that are really moving the world right now.
Right. Well, you know, the Christian church was created to control the population, control people's thoughts. It was made under the alliance with King Constantine, who wanted to control his kingdom. You know, and he says, well, we'll accept your philosophy, your spiritual path, as a way of controlling people's thoughts, and this is how we're going to control our kingdom, and we'll protect you now. We obviously needed a lot of protection, and it'll be a good symbiotic relationship. We'll be able to control everybody now, and so it started out as kind of a military deal, you know, in order to control people's thoughts. And Christianity, in a sense, they never really was a true pure Christianity, because Jesus kept saying when he was on earth, he says, you know, I've come to give the new truth, the new revelation. But what do we do? What do Christians do? That they give as much importance and emphasis to the Old Testament as they do the New Testament. So in a sense, Christianity is just another form of Judaism.
Right.
That's what makes it so patriarchal.
I see. I was going to ask you maybe in the last 10 minutes here. There's a thing called the Templar's Kiss that was placed specifically on certain parts of the body. Did the Templars have a certain name for this transfer of power from one person to another?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the name was, but that was actually, supposedly that was the way that the initiating Templar would transfer the Holy Spirit Kundalini power into the initiate. I'm not really familiar with exactly what the name of that was. They did it that way, but there was also the kiss. I think I mentioned in the book about kissing below the navel, at the base of the spine, and the east. Those are two spots specifically associated with Kundalini awakening, and gurus throughout time have always tapped those places in order to awaken Kundalini.
Uh-huh.
So these are, you know, these allegations that were placed upon the Templar before their mass arrest is, you know, for the most part, they were true. They had this big, gruesome sort of thing that they would worship on their highest mantles. That, today, we know it as the symbol of Baphomet, the goat of Mendes, that kind of grotesque-looking thing that's androgynous, and one hand's pointing up, one hand's pointing down. But they knew that that was a symbol of Kundalini. See, the Kundalini unites heaven and earth together. That's why it's pointing up and pointing down. Kundalini is androgynous. That's what happens when you unite the male-female. That's why Baphomet, the goat of Mende, is androgynous. You know, he's got a male phallus and female breasts. He was a form of Kundalini, and that's why he was dark too and destructive, because that's the energy Kundalini. It destroys in order to give you a new birth, to wake you up, to give you new life, you know, so you can be born again. And this is what, so this was this wisdom of the East that the temple was brought into the West, and the West didn't understand it. And they looked at that Baphomet, they looked at that energy, they said, oh, we know him, he's our devil, so sorry, guys, you know.
So that's
and that doesn't work for us.
Inquisitioners went after the Templars and tried to kill them all.
Well, that's exactly right. See, in the East, they love the gods and goddesses of destruction. They worship them. All the go-yogis worship them every single day. Kali, Shiva. Why? Because those are the energies that destroy everything to keep them from knowing the divine nature. They're limited concepts of reality. They're all their toxins in their emotional, mental bodies, their ego. It destroys all that so that they can wake up to the true nature. And so this is the wisdom that the Templars knew that they inherited from the East, but the West wasn't ready for it. They couldn't understand it.
Well, it seems to have survived a little bit, because all you have to do is drive around Washington, D.C., and you can see all of these Freemason symbols and geometries and relationships between buildings and centers of power, not just in D.C., but around the world.
Oh, absolutely. The Templars became the Freemasons. The Templars became the Freemasons. They invested Freemasonry with all their esoteric secrets right after 1307. They had to do something with them, so they made them part of Freemasonry. You know, so Templarism does continue to survive in a number of different ways. One way is through the Freemasons, absolutely.
Well, I know most modern Freemasons don't really understand. They understand the symbols in the sense
right.
that they memorize them, but it's little more than a boys' club today.
Unfortunately, and they're also being fed this kind of dogma that they aren't actually descended from the Templars, which is nuts, because even the Freemasons' own historians, like John Robertson, born in blood, their research has shown that the Freemasons were descended directly from the Templars. But some of them, for whatever reason, which I'm not sure, they're stuck on this idea that, oh, there's no connection to the Templars. You know, I don't know why, and maybe they've got some bias against the Templars, which I haven't been able to figure out, you know.
But I was exposed to that bias too, and I was quite surprised when I went to Stranraer and I found the castle built in 1319, and on every single wall in it there were Freemason symbols and the Flower of Life and all kinds of stuff. That I found the exact same thing on the walls of Roslyn Chapel built in 1442, so that goes, you know, way
mm-hmm.
back before, you know, Europeans said that Freemasonry started. So
absolutely,
God.
Yeah. I mean, the Roslyn Chapel became the mecca of both Templarism and Freemasonry. It's both, you know, and so that's the place where they're completely united. After 1307, a lot of the Templars went up to Scotland, and at that point they fought along Robert the Bruce at the Battle of Bannockburn for Scottish independence. And then after that time, Robert the Bruce actually founded the Royal Order of Harem, which is a Freemasonic organization for the Templars specifically. And it was at that time that the Templars poured their knowledge and wisdom into Freemasonry. And then later on, when James II was King of Scotland, went into exile in France, it was at that time that the Royal Order of Harem gave birth to the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which it is today.
Fascinating stuff. You just can't go very long in this kind of history, and then you start seeing the roots of virtually every major civilization, not just in modern times, but 10, 20,000 years ago. And you start seeing the roots of buildings that were sitting around when civilization, you know, hiked their way in from the coast or over the mountains. They walked in upon huge cities already built, already sitting there, you know, beautiful in splendor and unused or abandoned. All this stuff tells about the roots of humanity, and maybe even the relationship of humankind to other races on other worlds. And
oh, I don't think there's any question, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that we're reawakening to that, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what are the scientists saying about the junk DNA? Well, I think that's, you know, that's extraterrestrial DNA, you know, which makes a lot of sense.
I have someone that's just sent me a message. Is it known or have you heard that humans who have been reincarnated can throughout their lifetime after their bodies look make their bodies resemble a previous incarnate that that they have had a preference for? In other words, can you reshape?
No, I think that's absolutely true, actually, yeah. Because I'm quite familiar with the a lifetime that I had many thousands of years ago back in Lemuria. It was a continent that stretched across the Pacific, and I had a long whitish beard and not much hair, and I look very much like that today. And that's the one incarnation that I think I identify with and relate to more than any of the others. So absolutely, I think you can do that.
Wow, that's incredible. Anything back before Lemuria? Did you exist on another world or only this world?
No, I believe that I came from Venus. Before that, I'm not really sure. I think I'm definitely on the Venusian lineage. That's how I know this master, Sanat Kumara. I've known him before in the past, and this is why one of my jobs today is to help in his revival now, you see, and show the links and how he created so many of the spiritual traditions that exist today. So I know I came from the Venusian link, but a lot of the masters were coming from there. Before that, they were coming via the Pleiadian connection and also the Syrian connection. So I think I've been through those portals, maybe both of them at different times. I can't say I've woken up and had really very very distinct memories of that. It's been more along the Venusian line. That I'm quite clear about, but before that, I haven't had so much clarity on.
Wow, amazing. So you come with great enlightenment and a playful heart, and that's good. I think.
Well, I hope so.
I think this isn't going to be the last of Mark Pinkham with me anyway. I'm gonna try and hook up with you. I'm gonna try and go to this thing in Sri Lanka. I really want to take part in that. I look at the Agnew line, and there aren't many of us around. If you open up the phone book, there just are not many Agnews, and the reason I think is because the line has been pretty much wiped out in warfare or in land transfers or various things. But I do look back and see a line of preservation, and that maybe I'm here for a bigger reason than just to be a physicist and teach and lecture. And maybe.
Well, I certainly welcome the idea of you supporting and. The conferences that we're doing, and I think that I can tell you one thing. When we went to Sri Lanka, or I was in Sri Lanka recently, and went going around the island, talking to people about it, and getting speakers of the conference, everyone was like, "Wow, that's it! This is incredible! That's just what we need right now!" I've never seen such excitement, and it really feels like now is the time for these things to happen, So I'd like you to be involved. I'd like everyone to be involved,
Well, do me a favor. Send me a banner that you guys have put together on, and I'll post it on X Squared Radio and on Phoenix Science Foundation's website. And we'll send out some flyers with the books that we sell out of our warehouse, and we'll just see how many people can resonate with it.
Yeah, that'd be fabulous. Great. I appreciate that. Yeah, any way I can get the word out right now is what I'm trying to do, so...
Sure, I understand. When you're having a conference like this, a couple hundred people's nice, but 10,000 people would be a lot better.
Well, we have a hall right now that's going to seat 1,000, so ideally we'd like to get at least 1,000. Yeah, that's what we're shooting for. So.
Well, then that's what we'll manifest. That's what we're all about here, to try to help those things to happen.
Definitely.
My guest tonight's been Mark Pinkham, and his book is Guardians of the Holy Grail. He has a couple of great websites, bodymindspirit.com. serpentsofwisdom.com, and are there any parting thoughts the last couple of minutes that you have for us? What are you going to be doing the next 60 days?
Well, I'm going down to Peru. There's a gathering of called the Condors and Eagles. Eagles of North America and the Condors of South America. And the prophecy is that when the condor flies with the eagle, then peace will reign throughout the Americas. So we have a lot of Native American elders down there that are going to be doing a lot of rituals in order to help make that happen. And, of course, we're in Peru, we're in Titicaca. This is the homeland of the goddess. It's all about helping in the revival of the goddess. So the goddess is all about bringing everything back together. Patriarchy, the male principle, is divisiveness, is control and domination. And the goddess brings things back together. It's love and allowance, and so we're helping that to happen. I mean, all my books are dedicated to the goddess tradition. Our Templar organization is dedicated to the goddess, making this happen all around the world. And so this is one step there is to bring people together. And so we're going to be doing that in Peru, and I leave. We'll be there next Sunday. It's actually going to be on the equinox. And so it's going to be 7 p.m. Eastern time that we're going to be doing this. And so everyone can be involved if they'd like, if I tune into what we're doing at that time, you know.
Well, this is great. Well, you've taken another step here on X Squared Radio, and it's great guests like you that make X Squared Radio grow so fast. And hopefully we've given you the opportunity to tell a story you haven't got to tell somewhere else.
Yeah, and sure. And I'd definitely be interested in coming back at some point, too, and talking some more.
Excellent. Open invitation, and we'll definitely do it. I appreciate you coming on the program tonight.
Thanks, Brooks. It was great. Thank you.
No problem. Shortest 3 hours in radio. We'll talk to you later, Mark.
Take care, Brooks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. There you have it, Earth Explorers, Mark Pinkham. Be sure to pick up his book, Guardians of the Holy Grail. It is an encyclopedia of wondrous information. And don't forget to make sure to check out Marine St. Germain's Egypt trip coming up, 14 magic days in Egypt. We want you to partake in that if you can. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio, and I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.